especially if you just don't, you're having trouble getting it again. Anyway, so
it's going to benefit you as well by making sure that they have a job. I know we like to think that, you know, we're on an island and we're on our own path and we're our own
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight. We are in New York City at the United Nations Radio Row. This is their radio day where they, you know, focus on the work that they do around the world, highlighting some of the positives, the negatives, and really just spreading the word. Tonight we're going to be talking with a bunch of representatives from different organizations who work through the UN. We're going to be focusing on issues that have to do with workers' rights, children's rights. You look at some of this stuff, man, and what we allow to happen in this world to kids is just criminal. The fact that you look at different areas where they're drafting young boys into the military, where they're taking young girls and putting them into prostitution, just plain wrong. So we're going to be talking about that stuff tonight. We're going to be talking about gender issues. We're going to be talking about trade, because all of this stuff ties in together, and deciding what kind of a country we're going to have. On the home front, we'll be back on Monday in the studio live for your phone calls. And then over the weekend, I'll answer all emails, rick@thericksmithshow.com. And if there are any guests tonight that you want to interact with, we will make sure that we pass that along if you email us at rick@thericksmithshow.com. But on the home front, the battles are still raging. The workers' comp bill still being rammed through the legislature. This destructive piece of legislation written mostly by business interests, by the special interest, that Perry bill, 916, handwritten by the Chamber of Commerce and the NFIB, handwritten. I doubt that he had a word to say about it. But again, this is one of those moments where you go through and you look at what they want to do to us. And this is really a theft from those folks who need this unemployment at the most desperate time possible. Also, the workers' comp bill that they're trying to ram through, going to make sure that 95% of the injured workers in the state of Pennsylvania never get to see their own doctor. And that's just the way they like it. Make sure that you don't have a choice. It's kind of weird. You listen to them argue against the health care bill, and, oh, well, we want choice, except if you're an injured worker. Also, the voter ID bill they're ramming through, also the whole no rights at work agenda that they're trying to push through. Now is the time to stand together, fight back, call your representatives, be involved. This is D-Day for us. This is the time to step forward, step up, and make those contacts that have to happen. But again, today we're going to be in New York City, the UN's Radio Row, bringing you the guests that work for the UN, the issues that are important, the issues that are going out across the globe. A lot of stuff we take for granted in this country. I know I do. I know I'm one of those folks who, sometimes, you get tied up in the fight of the moment. Sometimes you get tied up in what's right in front of you, and you don't get to see the bigger picture. You don't see the global picture. Today, we're going to bring some of that right into your living room, right into your speakers, because, sometimes you need to step back and be appreciative of what we got. But also look down the road and see how can we make this world better? How can we make somebody's life a little bit brighter? How can we do it? And how do we change things for the better? I'm a big fan of transparency. I'm a big fan of, the sunshine being the greatest disinfectant. So again, if there is anything you hear tonight, you got a question, comment, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I will answer all emails personally. We look forward to seeing you back on Monday. And now, in this country, we take the press for granted sometimes. It is a constitutionally protected occupation. It is the fourth estate. We kind of take for granted. But there are places around the globe where putting out the message, telling the truth, reporting on a story could get you killed. That's why I've asked Susan Abilio. She is a senior communications and liaison officer for UNESCO at the United Nations. Her job here is to kind of promote the press, I guess. Susan, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you very much.
I look at this, and here in this country, right there, First Amendment, freedom of the press. That's not the case throughout the world, is it?
No, it's not. And actually, Article 19 of the United Nations Charter is based in large part on the United States First Amendment, which guarantees freedom of expression and freedom of the press. Regrettably, in many parts of the world, there don't exist, first of all, legal parameters in which the press can operate. There's no access to information. There's no protection of journalists. The biggest single problem is that too many journalists are killed for what they do, killed for writing things, killed for carrying out their jobs of trying to inform the public. And in too many cases, these deaths are never resolved. There are issues of impunity. There are numerous obstacles. First and foremost, the basic safety of journalists. I mean, I worked in journalism for 15 years, and you always had that shield of protection that you could really piss people off, but your life was very rarely under threat. That's not the case in many parts of the world.
Right. Again, I think we take it for granted, but places like, maybe Iraq, Afghanistan, mm-hmm. places like Mexico even, mm-hmm. you see reporters being killed for doing their job.
You do. And Mexico is a particularly troubling case because too many journalists are being killed for writing about the criminal situation in that country, the ongoing drug wars, which have absolutely paralyzed the country. It's a country I know very well, and it's really heartbreaking what's happening. It also is a country that has a remarkable press. The energy that journalists have always had, and I'm talking about the days when they really didn't have the freedom that they have today. And it's really regrettable that they don't have the kind of protection that they need, and a lot more needs to be done. I think UNESCO is very concerned about that situation, and it's also, at the same time, the country has come so far in these journalists being able to work. They just need a lot more protection that they will be allowed to write what the public needs to be here without the kind of retribution that they're receiving.
Yeah, you look at Mexico, and a lot of people believe they're in the middle of a civil war, and I would think that the first line of defense, the first line of either side would be to be able to control the message.
That's quite regrettable, and unfortunately what's happening with the drug cartels is that they're using the media in many cases to put out information about each other. So it's a terribly complicated situation, and I have to say that a lot of the good work that's being done right now is being done in the past on the part of NGOs such as the Committee to Protect Journalists to try to get media organizations to work together to come up with a scheme and a mechanism in which journalists can find a way of protecting each other. And the government is very concerned, and the government government is doing as much as it can really to protect them. It's just that it's such an anarchic situation with the criminal elements in Mexico that it's really quite unfortunate.
Yeah, in this day and age of remarkable technology, mm-hmm. Citizens, journalists, bloggers, however mm-hmm. you want to put it, are you seeing more opportunities for messages to get out, or are you seeing things being restricted more?
Well, there are unprecedented opportunities, and it's really remarkable the amount of information that's getting out on a daily basis through means that were just unimaginable a few years ago. At the same time, governments are getting more adept at preventing it, at shutting down systems. So we've got this paradox here of a moment in an era of remarkable effervescence in freedom of expression and freedom of the press, and at the same time the constant threat that this can be shut down on national levels in some cases. I think that there's been a lot of support, particularly in the countries where that can happen. I think that there have been efforts on the part of, say, foreign correspondents. Back in the old days when I was a correspondent in Mexico, when the press wasn't able to really report, when we all started covering the drug wars and writing about it, we became the sources, and we were actually the first sort of break in censorship within the country, because suddenly they could say, oh, the Dallas Morning News yesterday wrote about voter fraud, or the New York Times reported. So I think that today, when you have a case in some countries where journalists are shut down via the technology being shut down, that I think the foreign press is playing a greater role, and so are NGOs and humanitarian organizations. But it's undoubtedly a moment of unprecedented effervescence in the flow of information that's available to people. And people in countries now have information on which they can base decisions in their lives, and it's a remarkable thing.
You know, I look at Egypt as an example, and other countries mm-hmm. that have really, through technology, been able to organize and to use messaging to really mm-hmm. affect change.
Yeah, and actually what UNESCO is doing, particularly in the North African and Middle Eastern region, in countries like Tunisia and Egypt, that we're working with journalists. In fact, we just had a big seminar in our headquarters in Paris last week, bringing together leading journalists from both Tunisia and Egypt to look at the role of the press in democracy, and also to look at the role of public service broadcasting. Public service broadcasting is really being revived in many developing countries. It used to be a tool of, say, government propaganda, and now it's becoming a civil society vehicle, a way to provide more information in an objective way to societies. In these countries also, our role would be, say, to help devise Freedom of Information Acts. I mean, fundamentally, the biggest achievement, I think the biggest contribution that you can make to press freedom is to make information available.
Right.
Once information is available, it's like a floodgate that opens, and society has the information they need. So that's where our job will come in. We were instrumental in the case of Sierra Leone, post-conflict country, in writing, helping the government write legislation for a new public service broadcasting entity based more on, say, a PBS, BBC-type model. And we're looking at that now in Tunisia and Egypt as well. And it's exciting. You've got young people that have been providing information. You've got seasoned journalists that have seen so many changes in their lives. So it's really very exciting. In Iraq, the media now suddenly is covering elections. You know, we've been organizing workshops for reporters who are covering elections for the first time in Iraq.
Wow, that's impressive. You know, but the question is can you possibly have a democracy without a free and open press?
Absolutely not.
And I guess the question is, as you look around the world, what do you see as the condition of the free press? Are we moving in a direction of freer access, or one of more restriction? Or is it just depending on the territory you're talking about?
I think that overall, the pressure everywhere, domestically, internationally, and regionally, is for more openness and more opportunities, more access to information. It's really quite difficult to shut that down. It's, you know, countries, societies that may be more closed than others are aware, in many cases, of what's going on in other countries. And you look at the demographic bulge of young people for whom technology is far more accessible than older people. The accessibility of mobile phones.
Right.
Which is even more important in many ways than having access to the internet. And let's not forget about radio. Radio is still the most important media for a large percentage of the world. And that needs to be leveraged more as well. In fact, UNESCO, our governing board, as a specialized agency of the United Nations, we have our own member states that make our policy. We're going to be considering in October creating a World Radio Day.
Interesting.
As a recognition of the role of radio in providing information.
Let me ask you this. I know you guys do a prize every year for the for stories that you know move towards a freer press, mm-hmm. and you know maybe. Explain that first.
Okay, well, this is a World Press Freedom Day is almost 20 years old now. It started with a conference in Namibia, Africa, in 1991, a newly independent country, and the press came together and decided that democracy is vital for the future of this country and for democracies. It was, you know, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was a new sense of hope for the future. And it was when the issue of press freedom was really put high on the agenda for the United Nations system. And shortly after that, a prize was created called the World Press Freedom Award that UNESCO sponsors with the Guillermo Cano Foundation of Colombia. And you may recall that Guillermo Cano was a very famous publisher of El Espectador in Colombia. And he was murdered in 1986 by the members of the Medellin drug cartel. So the prize bears his name and UNESCO's name. And each year the prize is given to a journalist who is reported under extraordinarily difficult circumstances, and quite regrettably, in two cases, they were awarded posthumously, the journalists that were murdered for what they do. This is an independent jury of very well-respected individuals from the media profession on a regional basis. So it's not political, it's not decided by the UN, it's decided by the international media community, and UNESCO accepts the award.
Interesting. You know, we hear an awful lot about our media domestically here in the U.S., and some would argue that we probably don't have the most open and free media. I'd be curious your thoughts on the state of American media.
Well, I think it's remarkable. It's constantly changing, constantly evolving. I personally have been really impressed with the ability for media to evolve. I mean, just the business climate, the public climate. I mean, these new models for not-for-profit journalism. We're still getting such a tremendous amount of quality information that we sometimes take for granted. We don't necessarily find it on when we flip on the TV, but there are other places that we can get it, and we're very fortunate to have that. And we're also very fortunate to not have the kinds of restrictions that many developed countries have on information, you know, security restrictions and such, and I think that we need to be reminded of that. To remember that, how privileged we are.
I agree. You know, because I was just thinking, you know, is it that, you know, maybe we expect too much out of what we have, and maybe we don't know how it is in other countries, how restrictive it can be, and how dangerous the climate is for reporters.
Well, there's certainly the issue of physical danger, but then there's also the issue of litigious problems. I mean, in many countries, insult laws exist, believe it or not, that you can, if you insult or even mention a certain head of state, you can be thrown in jail. I mean, here it's the reverse. You know, the more important you are, the less privacy you have. I mean, we may go to extremes here, but at least we do have, we don't have those kinds of restrictions. And that's the other side of limitations on freedom of the press, the sort of the litigious areas, the civil areas, the you can get thrown in jail just for mentioning certain heads of state in contexts that are not considered appropriate.
Interesting. Susan Bialio, I appreciate your time. Senior Communications and Liaison Officer for UNESCO with the United Nations. Thank you so much.
Lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance. Public divided, either they love us or they hate us. Profit billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have took into account that we never give up. We'll be here one day longer. The people's voice is stronger. We work hard for our money, we work hard for respect. Keep fighting for these rights for generations that's next.
Class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. As new U.S. jobs creation weakened in May, United Steelworkers President Leo Gerard told the U.S. Senate committee that manufacturing and the nation's defense industries must be revived. Gerard says 6 million U.S. jobs and 57,000 manufacturing facilities were lost between 1998 and 2010. He calls this terrible manufacturing devastation a clear and present danger that has undermined America's economic security and is a direct threat to national security. The United Steelworkers are calling for immediate action with strategic and employment-linked policies, investments, and incentives to revitalize America's manufacturing sector. The National Labor Relations Board is widening its investigation into possible improper interference in the biggest union representation election since the election at Ford Motor Company 70 years ago. The NLRB is conducting on-site investigations now to determine whether Delta Airlines illegally pressured 30,000 ramp and gate workers to vote against unionization. The NLRB is also probing possible Delta labor law violations involving 20,000 flight attendants. The International Association of Machinists and the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, lost the union representation elections, but both are contesting the results due to alleged improper interference by Delta management. Connecticut is about to break new ground for states guaranteeing workers' rights to paid sick days. Jesse Russell reports.
Starting next year, Connecticut service workers won't have to worry about losing pay to take care of a sick family member or if they're sick. The state passed legislation this weekend that mandates 1 hour of sick leave for every 40 hours worked, up to 5 paid sick days per year. The sick leave can also be used for seeking service in issues of domestic or sexual assault. Nearly 40% of workers in the country lack basic sick leave, 60% of Latinos, and more than 50% of African Americans lack access to sick leave. Additionally, a whopping 80% of low-wage workers have no access to sick leave. San Francisco is one of the few cities that has mandatory sick leave, and a recent study found that two-thirds of employers haven't found that law to detrimentally impact the way they do business. The study also found that 1 out of 8 workers in spaces where they come into contact with the public said they were less likely to go to work if they were sick.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Around the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? My daddy was a miner and I was miner's son. And I fixed with the
Well, that's the question. That's the question you got to ask yourself. Which side of this equation do you find yourself? Sunday, on June 12th, the International Labor Organization, the ILO, is marking this year's World Day Against Child Labor with events across 50 countries across the globe. They're also coming out with a new report on children in hazardous work. I'm excited to take a look at that. This scourge, somehow we have to fight back. I'm sitting here with Jane Stewart. She's special representative to the UN and director of the ILO, the International Labor Organization's office at the UN. Jane, thanks for taking time for us.
Wow, it's my pleasure, and welcome to New York.
Thank you. You know, I'm looking at this this event on Sunday, 50 nations across the globe, this new report on children working in hazardous conditions. And, you know, you would think in this day and time, maybe some of this stuff would be the past.
You know, that's what we're fighting for. And, Rick, you put your finger right on it. We figure we should be able to have children out of hazardous work by 2016, and that's our campaign, along with a number of other UN entities. But right now, 115 million children, we're talking children, somewhere between the ages of 5 and 17, are working in hazardous conditions. They're either sex workers, so we're talking prostitution, pornography. They may be child soldiers, and we see the devastation that that brings to not only the child, but their family and their communities. They may be working in difficult sectors. You know, agriculture can be dangerous.
Right.
Mining can be dangerous. These particular sectors, we see children working in with no safe work conditions. They just shouldn't be there. They should be in school. They should be in school.
I absolutely agree with you, but the sad thing is here in this country, I can't believe it. I saw the woman, the senator there in Missouri, Ms. Cunningham, who put forth this bill to basically repeal all child labor in the state of Missouri. It seems to me to just be plain insane that while other countries are suffering and we can see that we would be talking about repealing our own laws.
Well, you know, I mean, the fundamental rights of children, when respected, make sure that they grow up healthy, educated, able to contribute and to support themselves, their families, and really our future. And we've got mechanisms that can target, hone in on particularly bad circumstances at the national level and help countries work their way out of that. The ILO, as you know, the International Labour Organization, is a tripartite organization. So it's an agency of the UN, but it's unique because it's not just countries, governments, that
right.
is, but also workers and employers that come together and argue out really tough issues associated with the labor market and ultimately come up with standards, regulations,
sure.
or recommendations that countries then can adopt. And it shows them how best to deal with some of these challenging issues. Child labor. AIDS, we're having the high-level meeting on HIV and AIDS here at the UN as we speak. How you deal with AIDS in the workplace and the rights associated with individuals and mechanisms to ensure they get information on how to prevent AIDS, workplace to place to do that.
Right.
Forced labor. Fundamental issues about, you know, how employment is an essential piece of a country's macroeconomic policy. I mean, if you don't put employment at the heart of your monetary policy and your fiscal policy, chances are you get awfully high unemployment for a long period of time after a financial and economic crisis.
Right. And, well, you know, you keep hearing this idea of full employment, which I'm a big fan of, but there are two very distinct thoughts. I'm sure there's your thought, which is that wages should be reasonable. You should have the right to collective bargaining. And then there's the Michelle Bachmann thought that if we got rid of minimum wage, we could have full employment, immediately.
Well, and, you know, the benefit of the International Labour Organization is here you have workers, employers, and governments coming together and jointly hammering out what you should do on issues of minimum wage. It's another one, you know. And it's not easy. Right now, we're in the heart of our International Labour Conference. It happens every year for a period of 3 weeks. The focus this year is on domestic workers and figuring out how best to engage domestic workers appropriately in the labor market, on social security and the importance of social protection. And it's interesting to watch the different parties go at it. And, you know, employers have a different view than workers, have a different view than governments. Sometimes it's employers and workers have the same view against governments. It's fascinating. But ultimately, we get these standards that countries can then say, okay, you know, all the parties associated in the labor market agree on this, we should look at it.
You know, what I found interesting is you have a report that they just put out at your conference there, the Social Security for Social Justice and a Fair Globalization. And in that, it says that only 20% of the world's working age population has access to comprehensive Social Security. And I look at that and I say, you know, here in this country, there are those who are talking about taking what we have away, somehow privatizing it, making this, you know, this bizarre system, again, putting us at the mercy of Wall Street. And I go, you know, 20% of the world, and we're talking about doing away with our part of it.
Well, there are different ways of providing Social Security. The private sector has a role to play in that, and so that's not necessarily bad. Every country figures out what the right balance is in terms of providing Social Security. But fundamentally, we know what's important, and that is providing pensions to people who are no longer able to work, and have got to have some kind of support to look after themselves. Unemployment insurance, it's a vital, vital tool, especially in times like this, that not only keep individuals whole, but also create a consumerism that you need to keep the economy rolling. Support for children. You know, not every family is able to earn enough to look after their kids and keep them moving along. We're talking about child labor. That's part of it, right? If parents had a job, a good job, if they had some support for their kids, they wouldn't be sending their kids out to work. So Social Security plays a fundamental role in quality of life, quality of society, and let's face it, it helps us in tough economic times as well. It's a stimulus, huh?
Yep. Well, I've always said Social Security was never meant to be a retirement program. It's an anti-poverty program.
Exactly.
It's to draw that line in the sand and say, you know what, no one's going to fall below this.
And when through no fault of your own, you need it, by golly, that's when the government becomes important to you as an individual citizen, right? And having those programs in place in a way that is useful and makes sense in the national context, let's face it. I mean, you know, countries are different. But understanding the importance of Social Security is a discussion that we've been having here at the UN in this last couple of years post-crisis, because people have recognized its value. And when you've got it in place, you know, not everybody uses it in good times, but in tough times.
Well, unemployment,
it's
especially,
that,
being
it's
the
that
same
floor.
Thing.
It's that
you
floor.
Know, do you notice other countries around the globe looking to our social safety net? Because I believe ours is fairly tattered. It's much weaker than I would want. Maybe much weaker than some other countries, much stronger than some other ones as well. Do you notice other countries looking to us and saying, well, we want to emulate parts of this?
Listen, there are some countries that have nothing. Well, there are some countries that have no or very, very minor targeted supports. So would they love to have something like you have here? Absolutely they would. There are other countries who have a very different perspective on Social Security than you have here in the United States, and it provides a different set of contributions and values. But again, it's about rights and responsibilities, people contributing, people receiving. But countries and governments, the electorate in a democratic circumstance, decides what will work best for them.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Jane Stewart. She's special representative to the United Nations and director of the International Labor Organization's office for the UN based here in New York. You know, you look at this, and the right to me to collective bargaining is one of those things that I almost see as sacrosanct. It's almost an absolute. But when we were in Wisconsin, and we were back during the, in February during the uprising, where Governor Walker wanted to take those rights away from people, there was actually a moment where the conversation had come to the ILO's certification of the forestry industry there. The fact that you were stripping these rights away from workers violated what the ILO stands for.
It's interesting because in 2006, I shouldn't be quoting a year now, but the membership of the ILO, the whole membership, decided there were some core standards that every country should be responsible for. One of those is the right to collective bargaining. And even if a country has not ratified the convention that has been established by the ILO, because not everybody, just because we do it at the ILO, doesn't mean at the national level a country has to ratify it. But even in the case of eight fundamental standards, even if a country hasn't ratified, to be a member of the ILO, they are subject to review. And, I mean, that's the power of an intergovernmental, international organization.
Right.
You know, it really does help try and set the bar and keep moving civilization forward in a fair way.
You know, I look at our labor laws and how fractured they are and how badly in need of repair that they are, and still they're better than some places, worse than most, though. Worse than a good number. I look at countries like, you know, China, a lot of human rights violations, a lot of labor violations. How do we change that? How do we move them in a better direction?
Well, and that's the power, again, of an international institution, an intergovernmental, and with our social partners, an institution. China's a member. And they come and, you know, they can be challenged in the context of the international organization on their application of those standards. And as I say, there are certain standards, even if they're not ratified at the national level, that can be reviewed and discussed and are reviewed and discussed at our International Labor Conference. So, you know, it is a place that helps move us to a different level when it comes to human rights. It really is focused on the labor market, but, you know, there is a fundamental right to work, a fundamental right to what we call decent work. So not just a job, not just any job, but a job that provides for your rights and social protection and gives you voice,
yeah,
both as an employer and as a worker.
You just threw up a right-wing frame there, and I want to kind of pull that back a little bit. You said that people have the right to work here in this country. We have that whole right to work legislation, and it's not the same thing.
That's
that
right. It's not the
about.
Same as the UN Convention, the Declaration on Human Rights, which does identify the right to work as being something that is, innate for every individual. And moving towards that, you know, full employment, as you pointed out at the top of the show, the top of the interview, is sort of the value set that the ILO is working towards. And it's not, you know, it's not officials, it's not bureaucrats, it's members of, you know, the labor administrations, workers and employers that get together and say, you know, these are fundamentally what we think you have to do to have a robust, effective, and efficient labor market.
Right, from your website, and I think this sums it up pretty well. The primary goal of the ILO today is to promote opportunities for women and men to obtain decent and productive work in conditions of freedom, equity, security, and human dignity. And you take each one of those, the freedom part, the ability to collective bargaining, the ability to have a voice in one's job, the equity, sharing in the wealth that you're creating, that security, knowing that tomorrow you're not going to come in, be fired, or who knows what, much worse in other countries, and that dignity that we're talking about.
It's about fairness. It doesn't mean people can't be fired. It's that there is a process that's fair, that people understand and can count on. It doesn't mean that workers don't have obligations. They do. It
Certainly.
Doesn't mean that employers don't have rights. They do. You know, so you turn sort of the whole context into understanding it from the perspective of all the players in the labor market. And it's not easy. It's not easy. You're talking about issues here in the United States. You know how complicated it is, right? But it's finding sort of those important elements that we have learned make sense and work and ensure that you have a productive economy that provides what it really should for individuals.
In your years of doing what you're doing, what story pops into your mind? What's that thing that tugs at your heartstrings?
Oh, there are so many. I mean, because as you say, we look at the issues of facing children in child labor and their parents who send them to work and don't want to because they haven't got a decent job, right?
To be honest, I don't want my 9-year-old or my 5-year-old in the workforce. You know, I'm a student of our labor history. I know that in our region, for instance, in the coal mines, 8-, 9-year-old,
Dangerous.
5-, 6-year-old kids were working in the mines.
Don't do that anymore. We know we've got better options to that. Issues of forced labor. You know, and it exists. It still continues to exist. Issues faced with labor migration. People migrate for work because they want to look after themselves, because they want to. And we've got to look at how those systems work effectively. But, you know, today it's really about globalization. And we know the world is changing. It's getting smaller, the dynamics of our trade. And having fair, just globalization where everyone can benefit is what's grabbing the attention of the members of the ILO right now. We're looking at the fact that, you know, the disparity between the haves and the haves not is growing within countries.
In wealthy
and
countries.
Exactly. You get and what do you do about that? You know, where's the real economy in this? And
it comes back to collective bargaining. It comes back down to
having a piece of it. It's a piece of it, but it's also about making sure there are jobs. And small and medium-sized employers are cash-strapped, can't get money from the banks, you know, post
Point.
This crisis.
Right.
And if they can't have access to the tools that they need to do what they want to do and employ, you've got an issue. So it's both the supply and demand side. You know, it's both about employability, but it's also about generating quality jobs.
So you think the whole neoliberal globalism, we're down that path. We're not turning around anytime soon.
We think we've got to look at it very, very seriously. And I'll tell you, you know, back in 2004, the International Labor Organization put together a world commission looking at the social dimensions of globalization and actually predicted that we were not using sustainable tools and mechanisms in the labor market, in the economy, that could lead to sort of what we saw happen in 2008 with the meltdown. So, you know, the world does come together. The world does think cooperatively on some really tough issues. And I think the challenge is making sure that we benefit and use that information and that knowledge as broadly and as effectively as we can.
Now, I know you guys aren't political by any way, but you know, you look at Colombia. We're talking about a free trade agreement with a country that takes trade unionists up in planes and throws them out or pulls them off of buses and shoots them in the head. In fact, 51 trade unionists killed last year. I'm sorry, I don't know that there's an agreement to be made with them, given that situation.
Well, those are things that I think the specifics are, you know, a challenge in terms of all our free trade agreements. But I'll give you an example of something that the ILO is doing in this area. We are working with international buyers, cloth, you know, garment manufacturers, who are importing from other countries, other regions, where labor rights are not perhaps at the level that we want in a strong democracy. So we've got a partnership of employers in those countries. I'm thinking of Cambodia, where we started, but we're in a number of other countries now. International buyers, governments, and the ILO goes in and does the monitoring of the work activities and actually places in the public domain results of our assessments, but works with the employers to improve those conditions with the employers and workers in that plant, which is good for the international buyer. They don't want to be buying garments made with child labor or with forced labor. They don't want to be buying garments and selling them if they're made by people who haven't got a voice at work or safe conditions.
Right.
So we're working at these kinds of things based on knowledge, research, and experience that is gained through the international context.
Yeah, my problem with the whole system is that we're exploiting these very, very low-wage countries that feed us produced goods, and they don't have a domestic market where they're not producing for domestic consumption. I look at the Chinese, for instance. Their entire model is based on export.
Trade is essential. Trade is essential, but so is having a good domestic economy that means countries aren't dependent on aid. And I think that's a fundamental point in this discussion for sure.
Great. Jane Stewart, I appreciate your time. Special representative to the UN, also director of the International Labor Organization, their office here at the UN. Thank you so much. Great talking to you.
Pleasure. Thanks for having us.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
A union man from the firefighters, my friend. And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting until the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg.
Do you know ALEC? You probably do, even though you never heard of it. Yes, it. Not a person. ALEC is the acronym for a secretive corporate-funded state policy front group, American Legislative Exchange Council. ALEC's exchange is very straightforward. It takes about $6 million a year from corporate powers in exchange for linking them directly to hundreds of right-wing state legislators. Like a speed dating service, ALEC convenes 2 to 3 dozen private confabs each year, putting corporate executives face-to-face with lawmakers. In these closed-door sessions, the special needs of corporations are matched with eager-to-please legislators who go back home to push the corporate agenda into state law. If your legislature is suddenly trying to take away workers' bargaining rights, outlaw citizen lawsuits against abusive corporations, privatize public schools, reduce corporate income taxes while raising taxes on retirees, and otherwise advance extremist special interest notions that go against the public will and the common good, chances are you have lawmakers who are carrying bills handed to them in one of ALEC's backroom tete-a-tetes. The organization brags that it has some 2,000 state legislators on its membership rolls and that members introduce about 1,000 ALEC bills each legislative session, passing about 200 of them a year. ALEC's insidious agenda is driven by a, quote, private enterprise board made up of such giants as AT&T, ExxonMobil, Koch Industries, Pfizer, and Walmart. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, don't bother asking ALEC for a list of the legislators who play in its corporate bawdy house. That's a secret, it says. But it's only kept secret from you. The corporate powers know all of ALEC's members intimately. Is your own legislator one of them? Well, ask him or her and see if they have the integrity to blush.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Your working class radio experience. Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left. Rich and far head is vacant. Oh, he's a working class man.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. We are here in New York City, the United Nations Radio Day. Talk Radio News Service invited us out to come participate in this. And, you know, a lot of people think about the United Nations. You think of, well, you think of police actions. You think of humanitarian aid. That's why, you know, I think it's interesting to come here, talk to the folks who run this and get the inside scoop. That's why I've asked Finjab Jinga to come sit down with us. He's the chief guy over at the communications department, the chief press service officer there at the Department of Public Information. Finjab, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome.
You know, when people hear the United Nations, most of the time it's in conflict. We're looking at Libya. We're looking at peacekeeping actions around the globe. And I think most people think UN, they think that.
Yeah. Given that it's mostly those kinds of issues that are that are prevalent in the media, but it's an important aspect of the work of the UN in terms of doing it best, bringing member states together to take a common position on resolving conflicts or keeping peace. But the work of the organization is well beyond that. There are some of those aspects of its work that you don't see in the public eye, that don't generate the same kind of attention because it's hard work. It takes a long time to see the success. If you look at the cooperation among states in some areas of health, agriculture, law, cooperation in on different transnational issues, if we take for example the issue of health, just during this week there is a high level meeting of member states on the issue of HIV/AIDS, how to stem its expansion and how to collaborate to look for, if not a treatment, at least how to alleviate the impact on people's lives, on children, on mothers, different demographic groups. Now, this is an issue that transcends all boundaries. There is no country can say that it has the capacity all alone,
right,
to deal with the AIDS issue. So that's one example in the health area. If you look at the issue of drugs, for example, which it's a problem in the U.S., it's a problem in Latin America, it's a problem in Asia, and no one single country has been able to address the issue of drugs, whether it be in terms of sales, in terms of production,
The war on drugs has been an absolute abysmal failure.
I
guess it's been an abysmal failure on stopping it. It's done a nice job of putting people in prison so that we can feed the prison industrial complex and pay shareholders into the privatized prison system we have, but that's a whole other discussion for another day.
Yes, in fact, you had earlier this week, there is a panel of some prominent international personalities, including former Secretary General Kofi Annan, former presidents or ministers who had studied how the world had been addressing the drug issue and found out that the way it was being handled wasn't quite adequate. So there is a big issue there. So the UN is more than what you see in the peacekeeping, even though that's an important part of its activity.
Well, you're supposed to be, as I understand, you're the arm that goes out there and helps with humanitarian aid, helps in times of crisis. You're the international body, if I'm not mistaken. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're correct in the sense that the UN provides a forum for member states. There are 192 of them. In fact, in July, there will be 193 when South Sudan becomes an independent country. But it provides a forum for member states to come and discuss common problems together, especially those issues that they can't handle by themselves or that countries identify as a major obstacle to their development.
Tell me some of the major successes that you see that the UN has been successful in dealing with problems, because we hear a lot of times that it's so big, it's ineffective, it's so bureaucratic that nothing can get done. Are there any examples of where you see their success?
Yeah, in fact, one of the fascinating things about the UN is that the areas where it has been most successful has become so much part of everyday life that you don't even associate it with the organization per se. Take the classic example of smallpox. That was eradicated decades ago. That was through it was within the context of the UN and collaboration among health institutions, among nations, that they were able to eliminate smallpox. If you look at there are certain international regulations governing either postal activity, like post offices. That's one area where there is international collaboration. When you mail a letter in the U.S. to go to maybe China or to Hong Kong, it goes through certain procedures, and all of that is governed by certain rules that were agreed upon by member states within the context of the UN. When you look at airline regulations, safety regulations, some of those things are so ingrained in national activity that you don't see the UN name in it, but those are some of the achievements that the organization has brought to our world. When you look at establishing certain international norms, for example, in 1982, they adopted the convention, International Convention of the Law of the Seas, that governs how some of the resources in the high seas should be managed jointly by countries.
Interesting. Yeah, because one of the things that I believe there has to be an overarching body so that we take care of things like Libya. I'm in no way, shape, or form in favor of what we're doing there at the U.S. side of this, but there has to be an international body that does take care of that.
Well, in the case of a situation like Libya, the action there is based on a Security Council resolution whose main objective was to protect civilians by applying a no-fly zone. And that is the basis for what's happening in Libya. Now, how far that has gone, the council hasn't reviewed it. The states that are active in Libya are supposed to report to the Secretary General every month on how they're implementing that resolution. So there is a basis for that. A resolution adopted by the Security Council.
How can you make things better? I mean, being involved in the thing, where do you see some of the failures being then?
Well, I mean, we should acknowledge that given the nature of the organization itself, the multitude of interests, it's not always easy to find common ground. So that's one difficulty. You have the Security Council, which is one of the major organs, which has 15 members. Of these 15, five are permanent members with the right to veto any action that they don't like. Now, there have been calls for that body to be reformed because people, it's generally felt, even by member states, that its current structure dates back to the post-Second World War and that the world has changed this far. And that the fact that it is the only organ of the United Nations whose decisions are enforceable, taken to be part of international law, that's why there's this call that there has to be the broadening of its membership and decision-making process. So there's some progress in that way, but still quite a long way to go.
For the average person, what do you think they should know? Because like I said earlier, I mean, most of the time you hear the UN, it's about these peacekeeping missions, it's about humanitarian aid. What should people know about the UN?
Well, they should look at the UN as part of the human experience. The world has gone through several wars. The nature of wars have changed, and as these, the nature of conflicts too have changed, new rules are being discussed in how to address some of these situations. We have the issue of poverty that is widespread, and it's only through cooperation among countries that we can look at some of the common causes. When we have natural disasters like floods, volcanoes, and the like, usually it's the effects are quite devastating. If you remember things like the tsunami that ravaged a lot of countries in East Asia, it's mostly through the UN humanitarian agencies, Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, UNICEF, and some of those agencies that assistance is provided to those areas, both in terms of relief and emergency assistance, and also in rebuilding these countries.
One of the things I would like to see the UN do is get involved more in this this mass inequality that's going on across the world, where you see hundreds of people controlling the amount of wealth of billions. There's a very real problem in the distribution of the wealth that's created in this world, not just in this country but across the globe. And it would be nice to see somebody fighting for that.
Well, you have some specialized agencies of the UN whose work is actually devoted to alleviating poverty, to providing support to those whose standards of living are very low. We have an agency like the UN Development Program, which essentially operates in the developing countries and assists those governments in their fight against poverty, in programs that alleviate poverty among the young people, among children, and among the most poor, especially in agricultural areas. We have agencies like the Food and Agricultural Organization that also provides support in terms of advice and assistance in developing agriculture in countries where there is fertile land and yet people die of hunger.
Last question I've got for you. You know, this Radio Row event that you guys are sponsoring today, what do you hope comes out of this? What's the hopes?
Well, we did consider that talk radio is a very powerful medium because of the light-hearted manner it's run and it's rich. It's not a classic targeted public per se, and it's a medium that generally we have not been using as frequently as we should. So when our colleagues decided that it was a good idea to invite talk radio hosts to come to the UN so that they can connect with their audiences, so our expectation is that on this day, I mean, we have it once a year, maybe this is your first time on coming here, that your audience will listen to all the interviews you've conducted, hear what you tell them about your experience from the UN, and at least know that there is a forum that it's a useful venue for countries to cooperate, and also to let them know what efforts are being undertaken, and that the UN is not just an abstraction, and that they your listeners, they are part of this UN in the sense that they are citizens of a member state, and a member state like the U.S. that, you know, contributes your tax dollars to its functioning. So it's important for them to know what the organization does. If you can take that message to them, then we believe that they can have some kind of input in how the U.S. government operates in the U.N.
And that would be a successful event. Finjep Jinga, I appreciate your time. Chief of the Press Service at the Department of Public Information at the United Nations. Thanks so much. I appreciate your time. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. As new U.S. jobs creation weakened in May, United Steelworkers President Leo Girard told the U.S. Senate committee that manufacturing and the nation's defense industries must be revived. Girard says 6 million U.S. jobs and 57,000 manufacturing facilities were lost between 1998 and 2010. He calls this terrible manufacturing devastation a clear and present danger that has undermined America's economic security and is a direct threat to national security. The United Steelworkers are calling for immediate action with strategic and employment-linked policies, investments, and incentives to revitalize America's manufacturing sector. The National Labor Relations Board is widening its investigation into possible improper interference in the biggest union representation election since the election at Ford Motor Company 70 years ago. The NLRB is conducting on-site investigations now to determine whether Delta Airlines illegally pressured 30,000 ramp and gate workers to vote against unionization. The NLRB is also probing possible Delta labor law violations involving 20,000 flight attendants. The International Association of Machinists and the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, lost the union representation elections, but both are contesting the results due to alleged improper interference by Delta management. Connecticut is about to break new ground for states guaranteeing workers' rights to paid sick days. Jesse Russell reports.
Starting next year, Connecticut service workers won't have to worry about losing pay to take care of a sick family member or if they're sick. The state passed legislation this weekend that mandates 1 hour of sick leave for every 40 hours worked, up to 5 paid sick days per year. The sick leave can also be used for seeking service in issues of domestic or sexual assault. Nearly 40% of workers in the country lack basic sick leave, 60% of Latinos, and more than 50% of African Americans lack access to sick leave. Additionally, a whopping 80% of low-wage workers have no access to sick leave. San Francisco is one of the few cities that has mandatory sick leave, and a recent study found that two-thirds of employers haven't found that law to detrimentally impact the way they do business. The study also found that 1 out of 8 workers in spaces where they come into contact with the public said they were less likely to go to work if they were sick.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hard-working men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here in New York City at the UN's Radio Day. We're in the UNICEF building across the street from the UN. They're having their big conference, I understand. Having a great time talking to folks. I've got Boaz Paldy here. He is the United Nations Development Program head of their video unit, which I got to think is just interesting as all can be. Boaz, thanks for taking time for us.
No problem. It's great to be here.
Yeah, being the head of the video unit, I mean, the stories that you guys have got to come across and the things that you've seen have got to be pretty amazing.
They are pretty amazing. What's very special about my job is that I have to know a lot about a lot of issues. So it changes all the time. So I get to see a lot. I get to be out in the field a lot, and I have to learn a lot about new stuff all the time. So it keeps me on my toes.
Before we get into the stories and stuff, I mean, how do you get your stories out? How do you do this through video? Because I think, you know, a lot of folks, you know, want to work on messaging. Video is right now one of the most popular ways. You know, give me some trade secrets.
So, you know, we've gone very strong on social network. We're very, very strong on YouTube. We're very strong on Facebook, Twitter. We do all of that. We have more traditional ways. We go through broadcasters, traditional broadcasters. We try to find new platforms, new initiatives on the web. We recently, last year, it wasn't that recent, but we joined this organization called One Day on Earth that basically set out to film on every country in the world on a single day. And with our network of support, we have country offices in 160 places. We were able to film ourselves in 110 places. Wow. On a single day. And actually the film is coming out on Monday that we got out of that. So we try new initiatives all the time. We try to be out there. We try to really try to be as close to the line as possible.
So tell me some of the stories you've seen, some of the stories that came out of that that one day.
The One Day on Earth project was really amazing because it really all happened on the 10th of October, 2010, and you saw the vast diversity of things that are happening in the world, but also the sameness. So you saw kind of like we had flood victims that were coming into refugee camps in three countries in completely different places on Earth. They were in Togo, in Africa, they were in Pakistan, and they were in Aragua. So in three completely different, and the situations were very similar. So you saw like tragic stories like that are similar. But on the other hand, you saw babies being born everywhere. You saw children playing everywhere. You saw a lot of the projects that we do that are similar, like protecting the environment, doing a lot of democratic governance stuff all over the world on a single day. It was very exciting.
That is interesting, you know, because, you know, it's an interesting point you bring up. I think, you know, across the globe, I think we all want the same things.
We all want the same things, I think, yes.
I think we want to live a decent life. We want to raise our children, and we want to have a decent existence.
I agree. I think that's really the core issue, is that we all want the same, and we all have the same needs and the same wants, but we don't all have the same possibilities, and that's where we try to come in and change that.
And that's, you know, again, you know, we all don't have the same resources or the same situations, as you said. And I think that's why groups like the UN and the ILO, who we spoke to earlier, the work you guys do is important.
Yeah, I really think it is. I mean, I was a journalist myself before joining the UN for many years, and I saw firsthand really the intense suffering of people around the world, where resources aren't as good, where war destroys places, where natural disasters destroys places, and it really is heartbreaking in the most profound way. And I think that, you know, an international organization like the UN, like the work that we do, the long-term work that we do, the short-term work that we do as well, is so, so important.
Yeah, I think in this country, speaking for myself, I think sometimes, you know, you get caught up in your own problems, that it's easy to overlook what's going on in places that are much worse off than we could ever have it here, and it's easy to forget.
It is easy to forget. You go through your life, and you have your own problems, and you have your own your issues every day, and you forget that people in sub-Saharan Africa can basically earn $1 a day, most of the people there. You forget that over a billion people on Earth exist on less than a dollar a day. And you forget that people don't have access to water. The most basic thing, that you open your tap and you have running water, billions of people out there do not have that
luxury. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and being behind the camera, you know, tell me some of the things that really grabbed you by the throat and just said, you know, this is just wrong.
You know, I was in the Haiti earthquake about 2 weeks after it happened, and as you know, and your viewers and your listeners know, it was the most devastating natural disaster the world has ever seen. But it was only a natural disaster of those proportions because Haiti is so poor. Exactly the same earthquake, or even a greater earthquake, in Japan didn't do that kind of damage. I mean, the tsunami in Japan was awful and terrible, but it was like a small percentage of the damage that was done to Port-au-Prince. And the same thing in Chile, where the earthquake was much, much higher 2 weeks later, and yet didn't do almost any damage at all. And the reason why Haiti was damaged so badly is because it's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, and there's no other reason for it. And it's heartbreaking to realize that just because of lack of resources and lack of infrastructure, so many people had to die. So that was like really very, very, very difficult to see, very difficult to be there.
I guess it's kind of fallen off the news because of Japan and because of Joplin, Missouri, and other places across the U.S., but have you been following the recovery? Are they recovering? Is this something that's happening, or are they just meandering?
No, I think there is a recovery. I think there is a recovery, but it's going to take a lot of time. Haiti was in a bad place before the earthquake. When the earthquake hit, the international community really got together and really put a lot of effort into, first of all, first response, getting people food, getting people shelters, getting people, you know, set up, and then starting the long-term development, starting to try and rebuild this country. And the Haitians themselves, all the Haitians that I saw, they said, you know, this is the worst tragedy that could possibly happen, but there is a positive to it, that we can now rebuild the way that we want to rebuild. So there is a rebuilding process. It's going. It's very slow. The United Nations reckons that it's about 20 years of intense work to get Haiti to a place where it could be as good as its neighbor, the Dominican Republic, which is on the same island, same resources, the same, you know, it's exactly the same geographic situation, but you know, we all know how the Dominican Republic is.
Yeah, and a completely different political system. And from what I understand, and you know, people that we've talked to over the last couple of years, that, you know, they've said that that's changing. That you're actually seeing communities coming together and in a more democratic fashion than you had before. So at the end of this, maybe could turn into a positive out of a horrible tragedy.
That's the sense that I got from the Haitians themselves, that they want to rebuild better. They want to make this a better place. They want to be like their neighbors. They want to be like the United States.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Boaz Paldi. He's the head of the video unit at the United Nations Development Program. In talking about stories, you laid out some ones that are heartgrabbing. What do you look at and go, you know what, that made me feel all right. That was good. We've done something positive.
There's a lot out there. We work every day in 167 countries to try and make the world a better place. That sounds kind of high and mighty, but it's actually what we do. We work.
Well, it's got to be great to have that as a goal. You wake up for
exactly,
that every morning.
Exactly.
I'm going to change the world today.
Exactly. And you go out there, you go into the field, and you know, when you sit here in New York and you're at headquarters and you know, you're a little slightly disconnected, you don't exactly know. But when you're out in the field, you see it being done. You see kind of like, you know, for instance, on the 8th of July this year, there's a new country in sub-Saharan Africa. It's very, very exciting. A country that was under oppression for a long time, or a people that were under oppression for a long time. South Sudan is going to become, I think it's the 52nd African country on the continent. And basically, that process of creating a new country was helped tremendously by the UN. And I saw that happening in action. We trained judges. We trained police. We built all the basic infrastructure of a country that you don't even think about. Whatever, what's behind the scenes. The basics is there with the UN's help. And it's very gratifying to see that and to realize that, yes, we've done it. There is going to be a new country and it has a good chance of succeeding.
Now, what kind of response do you get out of your video work? I mean, you look at Egypt, you look at some of the other places where, you know, social networking, social media has done some pretty miraculous things. I'm curious what kind of feedback you get on your
work. Yeah, we get mixed feedback. We're open. What's changed in social media is that now it's become more of a conversation. It's like we don't tell people what we want to tell them anymore. We start a conversation, and we're open to that conversation, although sometimes the conversation isn't exactly positive. But we're open to it, and I think we're having that conversation in the social media spheres, on Facebook, on YouTube, on Twitter. And I think that we get positive response, but we get also, you know, we get the skeptics, we get the people that think that we're not doing the work that we should be doing, and we're bureaucratic, we're overextended. There's that as well. But that's interesting for us to get that feedback from out there.
Well, any large organization is going to get that kind of a position. You know, and I look at, you know, some of the stories that you were talking about earlier, on the one day thing. You know, there's not really a lot of control in that message. It's people telling their stories.
It is, and that was what was so exciting about it. It was like, it was really democratization of filmmaking. We handed out cameras to 120 field officers that UNDP has, and we said, go out and film whatever you want. Just film. You know, if you can make it that it's close to what we do and it's important and it's, you know, it's related, great. If you can't, you know, maybe we could do something about the Millennium Development Goals. Maybe we could do something about something that's really important to your community or to you personally. And we got incredible stories from all over the world. We filmed, as I said, in 110 countries, and the stories are absolutely tremendous. And it really is you're completely not in control, but then it's like the community somehow managed to do it.
Yeah, it's we live in remarkable times with the technology that we have. That instantly you can be around the globe and you can see things all over the world, and it's just remarkable.
It is absolutely remarkable. It is. It's very exciting.
Boaz Peldy, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much. He's the head of the video unit at the UN's development program. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All righty, we're gonna take a quick break. Right back after this.
Of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Do you know ALEC? You probably do, even though you never heard of it. Yes, it. Not a person. ALEC is the acronym for a secretive corporate-funded state policy front group, American Legislative Exchange Council. ALEC's exchange is very straightforward. It takes about $6 million a year from corporate powers in exchange for linking them directly to hundreds of right-wing state legislators. Like a speed dating service, ALEC convenes 2 to 3 dozen private confabs each year, putting corporate executives face-to-face with lawmakers. In these closed-door sessions, the special needs of corporations are matched with eager-to-please legislators who go back home to push the corporate agenda into state law. If your legislature is suddenly trying to take away workers' bargaining rights, outlaw citizen lawsuits against abusive corporations, privatize public schools, reduce corporate income taxes while raising taxes on retirees, and otherwise advance extremist special interest notions that go against the public will and the common good, chances are you have lawmakers who are carrying bills handed to them in one of ALEC's backroom tete-a-tetes. The organization brags that it has some 2,000 state legislators on its membership rolls and that members introduce about 1,000 ALEC bills each legislative session, passing about 200 of them a year. ALEC's insidious agenda is driven by a, quote, private enterprise board made up of such giants as AT&T, ExxonMobil, Koch Industries, Pfizer, and Walmart. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, don't bother asking ALEC for a list of the legislators who play in its corporate bawdy house. That's a secret, it says. But it's only kept secret from you. The corporate powers know all of ALEC's members intimately. Is your own legislator one of them? Well, ask him or her and see if they have the integrity to blush.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
You helped to turn America blue. Now let's keep it that way. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. We're here in New York at the UNICEF building across from the UN for the UN Radio Day. Our friends at Talk Radio News Service invited us out to come talk to people about issues around the globe. I'm sitting here with Dr. Susan Bissell. She's the Chief Child Protection Person over at UNICEF. Dr. Bissell, thanks for taking time for us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You know, we see domestically some attacks on child labor laws, and I guess some people don't see it all that important, but when I look around the world and I look at the abuses of children and I look at the misuse, the abuse, the exploitation, I'm really concerned about even the most minor step backwards.
No, absolutely. And I think, child labor is a big concern of UNICEF globally. And we've certainly seen that robust laws and policies that protect children, that keep them where they should be, which is either playing or in school, certainly not where they're being exploited, where they're being prevented from living a childhood.
In school especially.
Well, exactly.
The reality is you look at all of the products that are on the shelves of the big box retailers. You look at the most of the products that we purchase, and they're made in places that do, unfortunately, exploit labor. I'm curious, or child labor especially. I'm curious some of the stories you may have come across in your travels overseas.
Well, I not naming countries, but I think there's probably no country that doesn't have a child labor issue right now. But I spent a good chunk of my career in South Asia tackling this very issue, in particular in the mid-90s. I don't know if you recall the garment sector issues in Bangladesh. They were huge. And when we began, there was the whole public face of this issue and what the public hears, and no, we mustn't buy those shirts at such and such a store, which
right.
I won't name. But it's not helping. And this is a big lesson for UNICEF and this whole process is we need to help educate consumers. People need to understand what's going on out there and how to prevent it. And a lot of this prevention work is ensuring that governments pay attention and resource high-quality, free, compulsory primary education for children and that we lay down some laws in these countries. But the answer isn't that we shut down an industry, for example. And we were very vocal. UNICEF was very vocal in Bangladesh about saying, hey, let's work together with industry to address this so that those 1.5 million women at that particular time in the mid-90s who were earning their living in garment factories, that they got paid properly and that kids weren't in there. Shutting down the industry was not going to be the answer in that case. And the knock-on effects of women working, so legal age, over the age of 15, light work, and then over the age of 18, under the right conditions, women and who work are less likely to marry early, to have their children early, those children die. It's a real sort of, it's a complex issue,
right.
But it's one that, we certainly need to be addressing. And related to this, if I may, is the fact that there are links now between labor exploitation and human trafficking. And that's happening in this country, and it's happening in every country.
Yeah, you look at this, and again, you go back and how in the wealthiest country in the world do we allow things like that to happen? But I think a lot of it is just people don't know. And then there's the even worse part of it, some just don't care.
Well, a combination of both. And I think one of UNICEF's big responsibilities, I think, is also to help people to understand how we can stop this, how we can prevent these things. And that's very much at the heart of our child protection work at UNICEF. And we work essentially at two levels, and you're right in pointing out the importance of laws and policies in every country. We need that legal framework, that policy framework. At the same time, UNICEF is working on the ground with families and communities, community leaders, religious leaders, others who are opinion makers in communities to really turn the tide on some of these, harmful practices, violations of children's rights.
At the end of the day, though, doesn't it come down to the workers having the ability to join and form unions, collective bargaining, the ability ability to, you know, have a say in the workplace, in these places.
Absolutely. And I think what you're saying is it's a multifaceted approach to all of this, and that's absolutely true. Rule of law, good governance, democratic society.
But at the end of it, isn't it our trade policies that are allowing those things not to happen? By some of the things that we do, the policies that we have, that don't hold those countries accountable. And if they do, it's kind of in a half-hearted way.
There's a lot more that could be done at a political level, you're right. But I think, you know, and UNICEF's real belief in all of this is that good development work on the ground has to march in time with that. So trade sanctions are not the answer where we're trying to protect children. That's not going to help. We really need to be in there working hand in glove, and it's complex, it's time consuming, but we'll get there. And we have many examples where we have been able to rid industry, et cetera. I think the important thing for your listeners is that most children who are laboring in exploitative conditions are not in the formal sector. They're in the informal sector. They're not in that garment factory. They're on some farm, you know, 7 million miles removed from anywhere a labor inspector is ever going to see. So one of the things UNICEF is doing, and successfully on many harmful practices, is addressing social norms. What is it in the society, in the community, that perpetuates, that allows the exploitation of children to continue? And if you can address that at the same time that you do all of this other work upstream, bingo. I mean, you're going to have some successes, and we do.
You know, I had a really long conversation with one of my Tea Party friends who bought into some right-wing frame that it's good to exploit those folks in these countries, because if we don't allow corporations to go over and exploit them, they're going to all starve to death. That was the basic premise of his argument, that allowing these companies to go in there, exploit the labor, you know, do all of the horrible things that we've seen, that there would be no jobs and these people would just all starve to death. They go, well, what did they do before the companies came there?
Well, that must have been quite a conversation. I hope it was a short one. I think one of the things we need to do better is show people what's happening and how to address it. And we, you know, we can step it up in terms of really good documentation available to the lay public about that, because we don't have enough information, good journalism, about the underlying causality and what kinds of exploitation are being meted out on the most marginalized populations on our planet right now.
Yeah, whenever I take my children shopping, we take a globe with us sometime and go, where's this made? You know, where are the items of clothing that you're wearing, where are they made, and under what conditions, and who? I mean, I have a 9-year-old daughter, and, you know, chances are, and if she lived in a different country, she could be the one making these products.
Yeah, absolutely. Or married early, or, you know, any number of things.
That.
I mean, no, and these are linked. I mean, I keep coming back to this early marriage issue. But, you know, one of the most important things in development right now is creating, we've seen it in the Middle East, is creating good livelihood opportunities for young people who are educated, in fact. And I link it to early marriage, because this is what ends up happening to girls who don't go on and sort of develop throughout their later childhood, their, you know, adolescence and later when they finish school. And a girl who is married before the age of 15 is twice as likely to die in childbirth as her, you know, more adult peer. So, you know, these are connected issues, and then they need to be addressed with a sense of urgency.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Dr. Susan Bissell. She's the Chief Child Protection Officer, Program Officer there at UNICEF. You know, in looking at some of this stuff, you know, I often wonder, you know, what's the best thing for consumers to do? What's the best thing for people to do to help? I mean, you know, we see these late night commercials on, you know, save the children, send a couple of bucks. Is that the answer? How do we fight some of this back?
Well, I think the thing that you're doing with your 9-year-old is a big start. You know, we need to help our own children be aware of what's going on in the world and what's going on, what's happening to children. Writing a check to UNICEF, of course, would not be a bad idea, but, and I'm somewhat facetious there, I think getting active, being informed, write the checks, okay, write your congressman, get involved politically, be aware, take action. I mean, you have the power to do something about many of these things. Apathy is the enemy here, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, let's do a little commercial for UNICEF. What is it exactly that you guys do? How do you, you know, what should people know?
Well, I think what people should know about child protection and UNICEF right now is that we're active in more than 170 countries. I think you saw us best in action in Haiti following the earthquake. And what we're really trying to do is prevent the exploitation from ever happening. And that's a huge part of our work in all of those countries around the world. A focus on children, absolutely, and on children in the context of their families. Family strengthening is huge for us and fundamental to ensuring that we don't have children trafficked into exploitation of many, many forms.
Yeah, 'cause I don't think anyone truly wants to see children exploited or abused in any way. Last question I have, you know, I'm big on stories. What's the most heartbreaking story you've come across in your time?
It's connected very much to the apathy I've already touched upon, and that is the children that I met in Bangladesh, in fact, who were, if you can imagine, a country where there's no gravel, there's no, you know, dirt for making a driveway or anything. So we have thousands, if not millions, of children who are taking bricks that have already been made, probably by other children, and are sitting on their haunches 12 hours a day with a little hammer in their hands and a little nail, and they are breaking these bricks to make gravel. And that is the life they know. That is the only life they know and the only life they will know. And I will never get that image out of my head because it has a sound, you know, the sound of that hammer and in the heat of the day. And I walk away from that and I think how many people don't know or are apathetic or who give up on these interventions. And I've been thinking a lot. I'm reading a Susan Nyman book right now and thinking a lot about, you know, kind of morality and how, you know, even if things take forever and they're expensive, we need to do them because they're the right thing to do.
Yeah, and especially now when we're hearing these budget cuts and I hear people saying, oh, we need to cut off all this foreign aid. I'm going, that's not the answer.
Not if we're a human society. No, it's not the answer.
And it all brings us back to that. Are we a Christian nation or not? I keep people keep telling me we are. Susan Bissell, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much, and thanks for the work that you do.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we're going to take a quick break right back after this from New York City here at the UN Radio Day. Right back after this.
Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
You've reached Jenny in the Accounts Receivable Department of Dent Supply International. I can't come to the phone right now. Please leave a message and I'll return your call as soon as I'm available.
Jenny was in constant pain and missing too much work.
I wasn't reliable. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't be what I wanted to be. I knew that I could do my job better. I knew that I could be a better mom. I could be a better wife. But my body wasn't letting me.
Fortunately, Jenny's employer has Capital Blue Cross, and Capital gave Jenny a whole set of services called Better Health Works. Jenny filled out a profile, got online coaching, and called a nurse line.
She talked me out of a very dark time because I didn't know what else to do. Since I had my surgery, now I can give my employer and my family 110% of me.
Capital's Amy Montgomery is happy that Jenny is happy.
It feels great that Capital Blue Cross was able to help Jenny this way.
We really believe in what we do, and I think that that's one of the things that makes us successful. I think it's a perfect example of when you care more, you do more.
Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. We're here in New York City, the UNICEF building, just across the street from the UN Radio Row, Talk Radio News Service, UN Radio Day, talking about things the UN works on, some of the things going on around the globe. The other day, I happened across a story that talked about the possibility of another arms race between the U.S. and Russia, and you kind of wonder, can we afford to go down that path? Kind of makes you wonder. I've got Randy Rydell, Ph.D. here. He's a senior political affairs officer at the office of Mr. Sergio Duarte at the Disarmament Affairs Office there at the UN. Randy, I appreciate the time. Thanks for sitting down with us.
Glad to be here.
You know, I look at the story that I saw with, the Russians and the U.S. fighting kind of over the missile defense. I know it's an important issue, but, can we really afford to go down that path of the Cold War again?
Well, no one wants to go back to the Cold War in terms of the risks involved and all the costs of maintaining that weaponry, especially now that relations are starting to improve between the United States and the Russian Federation. But this missile defense issue is really a thorny one for a lot of reasons. First, it's hard to argue against missile defense because it logically just protects you against incoming threats. But the problem is that if one country develops a really effective missile defense, it presents other countries with the problem of how do they respond to it.
Right.
And it could serve as a stimulus to encourage other countries to expand their missiles or to put multiple warheads on missiles or to make them stealthy or to make them low flying so that they can evade radars and things like that. So an innocent gesture of trying to protect yourself can actually lead to an arms race. And this is what we're seeing right now, and this is why the U.S. and Russia are meeting privately to try to work this out so they can develop this system cooperatively rather than in competition with each other.
Yeah, because I can see how the Russians would go, I don't know that I'm so fond of you having a defense in my backyard. Like, we wouldn't be happy if there were one in our backyard.
Well, the Russian concern, whether it's valid or not, is that this will be kind of the camel's nose in the tent. It will be the start of a defense system that will grow in time and become more and more capable and eventually will jeopardize Russia's strategic missiles and nuclear assets. This is why the Russians are concerned. And, their basis for their concern is the fact that after the Cold War ended, NATO expanded eastward, and more countries are joining NATO. So from the standpoint of the Russian, defense establishment, they look at that as a threat, and they're very suspicious of it. So there are ways of addressing this. You just have to work it out diplomatically. That's why they're doing these talks, and it's probably a good idea that they go on, that they continue.
Yeah, I agree. But I look at the budget fights that we're having right now. I look at the massive debt that we have, the deficits we're running, the fact that we're looking at allowing education to crumble as we've allowed our infrastructure in this country to crumble for more bombs, more aircraft carriers. I just saw a story the other day. The Chinese they're working towards their first aircraft carrier.
Yeah. Well, now that you've raised this issue, let's think about this for a sec. Last year, the world spent a figure of $1.6 trillion on military spending. Now, in the last minute I've been talking to you, that expenditure has been $3 million. In one day, it's $4 billion. In a year, $1.6 trillion. That is mind-boggling how much money that is, and it happens every single year. Just with respect to nuclear weapons, the Brookings Institution did a study in 1999 trying to tote up how much just one country, the United States, has spent on nuclear weapons in its history. And the figure was $5.6 trillion.
Wow.
Now, think about that. That's a stack of dollar bills going from where we sit to the moon and almost all the way back to Earth. If you took that same amount of money and made a ring around the equator, it would go dollar to dollar 105 times around the equator with a wall 8 feet tall. That's how much money that is. And you have to think, do we have other possible uses of those funds? Now, remember, that number I gave you, that $5.6 trillion number, was for 1999. That's over 10 years ago, and that's only one country.
That's amazing. And you go back and you listen to the Eisenhower farewell speech, and it really rings quite clairvoyant.
Absolutely.
And I look at this, and now we've got all of these, and they're around the globe, And how do we get them back? How do we get them under control? And what worries me is what happens if they get into the wrong hands. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at Pakistan, a very unstable area, and they're a nuclear power.
Well, we got effectively various arms races going on in corners around the world. There's one problem in East Asia with the rivalry between North and South Korea and the continued nuclear developments in North Korea. There's the continued tension in the Middle East with respect to the concerns over Iranian nuclear efforts, concerns over the Israeli nuclear capability and the implications this has for the Arabs in the region. There's the rivalry between India and Pakistan, and there's the billions and billions that are still being spent on nuclear weapons by the existing nuclear possessor states. And all of these are problems. There's problems from the existing weapons, from their spread to other countries, from their acquisition by terrorists, and from the nightmare of regional wars going on.
You know, I look at the money that, again, you talked about the $5.8 trillion to make them. How much is it going to cost us to get them under control? Because I know one of the programs was going up and buying them up. The Soviet states needed the money. We've been, I guess, more than happy to buy them back. How much is that going to cost? And then what do we do with them?
Well, many years ago, I used to work in the U.S. Senate. I worked for Senator John Glenn. I was his nuclear nonproliferation advisor. And one day he gave a speech, and the statement, the theme of it was, pay me or I'll proliferate. Now, what does this say? It means that there's a hostage situation here that could materialize, where countries could threaten to acquire the weapon unless we buy them off. And the problem is one of insolvency. We can't go around the world trying to buy off every state because, first, our treasury is not that large, and second, the price will always be going up.
Right.
So at some point, you got to start saying that there may be certain cases where diplomacy can work in that area. But on the other hand, I think what's more important is to try to make these weapons undesirable and illegitimate wherever they are.
Well, you're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Randy Rydell, Senior Political Officer with the Disarmament Affairs Office there at the United Nations. You know, I look at this, and again, you know, it's what's scary to me is, you know, this weapon gets into the hands of someone who hates us, and then we end up in a situation where perhaps we see it come to our shores.
Well, let me just talk about this for a sec, because to make a nuclear weapon, you need two kinds of special metals. One is called plutonium, and that's produced as a byproduct in a nuclear reactor. It's like a waste, basically. And after you operate a nuclear reactor for a little while, you got to take that fuel out, and you can separate plutonium, and you can make that into a bomb. It's that material that blew up Nagasaki in 1945. That's plutonium. You only need about 16 pounds, about the weight of a bowling ball, which is about the size of an orange, by the way, because it's very heavy material. That's all you need to make one nuclear weapon using plutonium.
Okay.
Now, another one is highly enriched uranium, and this is the stuff that blew up Hiroshima in 1945. And this stuff, you need a little bit more. You need about 50 pounds of that. But again, it's a very small size. And the problem with highly enriched uranium is that if you have enough of it, you can get a nuclear explosion just by pushing two pieces together at a very high speed. The bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima had never been tested. Even in 1945, they were so confident it would work. And the principle was so simple. It's just a matter of taking two big pieces of highly enriched uranium and slamming them together at high speed, and that's what produced Hiroshima. So the problem is the ease of making such a weapon, and secondly is the dual-use nature of the technologies that make those materials. The enriched uranium came from an enrichment plant that could be used to make peaceful uses of nuclear energy.
Which is why we're
fuel,
afraid
yeah,
about with
exactly.
Iran.
What's wrong with peaceful uses of nuclear energy? Well, it can be used as a cover for military programs, and it has been historically many, many, many times. And the same with respect to plutonium. Also, the more of this stuff that's produced, the harder it is to control, because there's always a little bit that you never see missing because of just measurement errors. And so that's the problem, that somewhere there's going to be a black market being formed, and we're already seeing illicit transfers of these materials in small quantities. And who knows what's out there that we're not seeing. So, yes, I take it really very seriously. It is definitely possible, and I think it is a growing threat.
So what are the chances of their possibility being one of these dirty bombs showing up in one of our cities?
Well, it's a horse race, really, in terms of both technology and politics. The horse race is between the ability of the terrorists to get a hold of that material and then make a bomb and smuggle it in the country, and versus the other horse, which is the technology of being able to detect that material before it gets in the country. There are sensors and special detectors that we put in ports around the country to, in order that they can sense this
right.
stuff. But you have to put it into perspective. How good is that sensing capability when you, if you visit the port of Long Beach, for example? Take a look at the container boats coming in there. They come in by the hundreds,
yep.
and they're loaded with these giant boxes that, I mean, how in the world, even if you have a really good detector, you're going to be able to really search each one of those things and have a high guarantee that you're going to be able to detect it? No, it's a very, very tricky problem, both so I think ultimately you're not going to solve it technologically. I think what you're going to solve it is having to find why these countries are or groups are seeking these materials and try to stop that, try to address the sources of why they are doing this.
Now, is that the work that you're doing at the UN?
The UN is working in various ways to stop the spread of nuclear weapons and to prevent nuclear terrorism. Our own office works on the principle that the best way to stop the use of these weapons, nuclear, chemical, and biological, is to get rid of them all. Because anything short of that is risky. You're going to have risks of accidents, risks of theft, risks of terrorists getting a hold of those weapons, and all kinds of other problems. So that's what we're focused on. Now, there's other parts of the UN organization that are helping the Security Council in implementing UN sanctions. Like, for example, we have sanctions on Iran. We have sanctions on North Korea. There's committees that have been set up in the Security Council, and it's under the obligation of each country to have laws and regulations to prohibit the sale to those countries of technologies they can use to make nuclear weapons. And in 2004, the Security Council adopted a resolution which requires each country, incidentally including the United States, to have domestic laws and regulations to prohibit the assistance of any non-state group getting weapons of mass destruction or the proliferation of those weapons to other states. This is an obligation not just on the U.S., obviously, but on each member of the United Nations must by law now have those kinds of legislation in place.
Oh, that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
You know, a second ago you said to find out why these countries are have problems with us. I got to be honest, you know, dropping bombs on them kind of has a destabilizing effect. You look at what we did to Afghanistan and Iraq. You kind of wonder why they hate us?
Well, each time a country has acquired nuclear weapons, it's done so on the basis that the weapon is needed to deter foreign threats. Now, if you look at the cases of countries that have recently been either got the bomb or are suspected of working on them, countries like, for example, India, Pakistan, North Korea, and Iran, each one of them has either acquired those weapons or threatened to acquire them because of concerns over the fact that they themselves are being threatened by those weapons. And so you just have to try to put yourself in the shoes of the defense minister of the other country and imagine how you would look at the situation if you're being threatened.
Sure,
what would
I understand
you do?
It. You know, if the other guy's got a sword or a gun, I'm going to want the same thing. I'm not going to want to be at the mercy of somebody else.
Yeah, you don't want to go to a pistol fight with a knife.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Which is what, you know, unfortunately, you know, you go back to the, you know, bringing up Iran, you go back to the Iraq-Iran situation. You know, Iraq was fully with a whole bunch of chemical weapons and all kinds of weapons of mass destruction. And I don't know if I was Iran, I wouldn't want the same thing.
Yeah.
It's one of those scary, scary things. Mm-hmm. And the further down this path, the worse it gets.
Right.
But, yeah, I don't know.
That's why I say we got to get rid of all those suckers. They do nothing but cause instability and risks and jeopardize the economies and lives of millions of people around the world. They really, it's time for them to put to bed.
Absolutely. Randy Rydell, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much, sir.
Thank you.
It was great talking to you.
Yep.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner error, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. Jeff Holtzman, Talk Radio News Service. Jeff, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, glad to be on, Rick. Thanks.
I guess some numbers on Libya coming out?
Yeah, it looks today that the Defense Department has confirmed the cost of the U.S.'s military involvement in Libya, and it's a lot more expensive than I think a lot of people thought. It looks like we're spending about $2 million per day, roughly, which equals somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 to $60 million a month in Libya. Now, we're talking about the sorties that we're flying, refueling the flights, as well as reconnaissance missions. And a lot of folks think that, you know, we handed off this mission to NATO a couple months back, and then we kind of got out of the picture, but that's not really the case. We're actually a major player in NATO, and the reports today found that we're flying about 30% of the sortie missions. We're contributing about 75% of the cost of refueling flights, and we're doing about 70% of the reconnaissance missions. So we're very much actively involved in Libya, and in terms of an end date, an end game for this, it's really unclear. You know, the NATO operation was extended by 90 days a few weeks ago. So we'll be there for at least another 3 months, and then beyond that, it's anybody's guess.
Yeah. Again, right from the beginning, I was against this. I think it's a bad idea. I thought it was a bad idea from the beginning. I think it's a bad idea now, regardless of the cost. I guess Newt Gingrich has got some real troubles coming up.
Yeah, shifting to presidential politics, Newt Gingrich, a number of his campaign aides today announced that they will resign effective immediately, and one of them is the campaign director. So this has to be seen as a blow to the Gingrich campaign, which, of course, got off to a shaky start right out of the gate. The first couple weeks were not a good first few weeks for Newt Gingrich, or any presidential candidate for that matter. Newt Gingrich followed that up by going on vacation with his wife. They took a cruise in the Mediterranean, and a lot of folks looked at that and were sort of scratching their heads and saying, well, that's kind of an interesting strategy. Gingrich was in New Hampshire today. He released a statement after the news broke of his aides leaving. He said, I'm still going to run for president. I'm still in this thing, and the campaign resumes on Sunday in Los Angeles. We'll see how serious he is.
Well, I mean, I think he took a page out of the John Kerry book. You know, go on vacation at the worst possible time for your campaign. And good for him. You know, I'm not a big fan of Gingrich. Nice to see good things happen to him. Some other news out of Washington. The Gang of Five, any news on this deficit?
You know, the Gang of Five might have lost a member over the last few weeks with Tom Coburn sort of bowing out, but these five senators say today that they are still committed to putting out a budget plan which will include a number of proposals aimed at deficit reduction. Their plan, reports indicate, would cut about $5 trillion worth of spending over the next 10 years. So they're sort of upping the ante because President Obama, of course, in his recent speech a month back or so, said that he wanted to cut $4 trillion and put it towards deficit reduction. Now the senators are saying $5 trillion is the benchmark. Their plan is, of course, expected to include tax reforms. And in terms of that, they'll probably look at lowering tax rates, but at the same time, you know, possibly limiting tax expenditures, tax loopholes for corporations, things that the Simpson-Bowles Commission proposed back last December. They'll also look at cutting domestic spending, non-discretionary, discretionary, all that good stuff.
Any discussion about raising revenue? I mean, you know, it's nice to say we're gonna bring down the spending side, but if you're not raising revenue, it doesn't matter. I mean, Pallente came out and said we're going to cap it at 18%, but his tax plan brings in 14% of revenue. We're still talking about almost 4% in deficits on into the future.
I think what these senators are cognizant of is the fact that if they were proposing any tax increase, that would be a non-starter with the House, which, of course, is controlled by Republicans that don't want to see that happen and have pledged to block any plan that includes a tax increase. So I think that's completely off the table at this point. What they're going to try to do in terms of generating more revenue is to try to bring back some of that money that corporations, big businesses are storing overseas. They're going to try to eliminate tax expenditures. You know, mortgage interest deductions is something that the Simpson-Bowles Commission proposed. That might be in the Gang of Five proposal as a way of generating more revenue.
And lastly, I guess you got to talk about it. The Wiener's back in the news, I guess. More Wiener. Is his Wiener cooked? Big Wiener. Whatever. What? I'm so tired of this whole thing.
It's getting a little stiff, isn't it? I'm sorry. I had to.
It's hard to keep this up.
The latest with Anthony Wiener is he is sticking to his guns. He's saying that he's not going to resign no matter what. He has no plans at resigning. And, of course, everybody on this planet not named Congressman Anthony Wiener is speculating that he will resign. It's just a matter of when, whether it's this week or later on this month. Now a number of House Democrats are leaning on him to resign. Alison Schwartz, of course, who is with the DCCC, and Joe Donnelly becomes the latest prominent House Democrat. He, of course, is running running for Senate next year for the seat that Dick Lugar currently occupies, and he said enough is enough. Anthony Weiner has to go. If Anthony Weiner chooses to stay, you can bet that there's going to be an ethics investigation into his conduct. And, of course, we found out all of this on the same day that reports came out that his wife, Huma, is pregnant with their first child. So his situation very messy for the Weiners.
It is sad, sad news. But, again, I don't think it's something he should resign over. That, I believe, is for the voters to decide. If the Ethics Committee finds he did something wrong, there's recourse for that. But that's what the voters are for. Jeff Holtzman, I appreciate the time. Talk Radio News Service, thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. As new U.S. jobs creation weakened in May, United Steelworkers President Leo Girard told the U.S. Senate committee that manufacturing and the nation's defense industries must be revived. Girard says 6 million U.S. jobs and 57,000 manufacturing facilities were lost between 1998 and 2010. He calls this terrible manufacturing devastation a clear and present danger that has undermined America's economic security and is a direct threat to national security. The United Steelworkers are calling for immediate action with strategic and employment-linked policies, investments, and incentives to revitalize America's manufacturing sector. The National Labor Relations Board is widening its investigation into possible improper interference in the biggest union representation election since the election at Ford Motor Company 70 years ago. The NLRB is conducting on-site investigations now to determine whether Delta Airlines illegally pressured 30,000 ramp and gate workers to vote against unionization. The NLRB is also probing possible Delta labor law violations involving 20,000 flight attendants. The International Association of Machinists and the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, lost the union representation elections, but both are contesting the results due to alleged improper interference by Delta management. Connecticut is about to break new ground for states guaranteeing workers' rights to paid sick days. Jesse Russell reports.
Starting next year, Connecticut service workers won't have to worry about losing pay to take care of a sick family member or if they're sick. The state passed legislation this weekend that mandates 1 hour of sick leave for every 40 hours worked, up to 5 paid sick days per year. The sick leave can also be used for seeking service in issues of domestic or sexual assault. Nearly 40% of workers in the country lack basic sick leave, 60% of Latinos, and more than 50% of African Americans lack access to sick leave. Additionally, a whopping 80% of low-wage workers have no access to sick leave. San Francisco is one of the few cities that has mandatory sick leave, and a recent study found that two-thirds of employers haven't found that law to detrimentally impact the way they do business. The study also found that 1 out of 8 workers in spaces where they come into contact with the public said they were less likely to go to work if they were sick.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty when we look into the eyes of our kids. Cause brothers, it's a fact, if we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some dude up above us. Let's leave some green on the ground. It's only ours to follow. Let's save some for tomorrow. Let's leave some green on the ground. Well, it's only as to borrow. Let's save some for tomorrow. Leave it and pass it on down. So let's leave some blue up above.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Here in New York City at the UN Radio Day, I got Dan Shepard across from me. He's the information officer for the UN Department of Public Information. Dan, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I saw the other day Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney came out and said that he believes that climate change is something that's man-made. I thought it was quite interesting that a Republican would come out and say that, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Well, the science increasingly shows that climate change is happening, and it's caused by human activity. There's really not much credible debate on that. Most of the debate on this comes from political concerns or things like that. But as far as the science goes, over and over again, we hear the same thing confirmed again and again, that it's real, it's happening, and it may be happening faster than we thought.
Right. You know, I think most people, especially here in the U.S., maybe we're not seeing it as quickly as maybe some other places. I'm curious, around the globe, do you have some examples of where that may be something that would, you know, point out to people?
Well, there's a lot of examples. I mean, over the last year, I mean, some of the weather the world has seen has been pretty much in line with what the climate scientists have been telling us would happen.
All the tornadoes especially.
What they've been saying, we're going to see more intense precipitation events, flooding and things like that, more intense droughts. We're going to see melting of the glaciers, and we are seeing that more and more at a faster rate. Some of these really weird weather patterns we're seeing in the United States even, while we can't attribute any one weather event to climate change, some of them are pretty consistent with what the climate people have been saying, especially about the drying out of the Southwest and other another areas. The floods in Pakistan that we had last year, the fires in Russia, and also one that a lot of people don't see is oceans. Oceans take up an awful lot of carbon dioxide, and they are becoming increasingly more acid than they have been. And that does a number on ocean habitats and coral reefs, which are essential for people's jobs.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you. My wife and I are scuba divers, and one of the things that we keep an eye on are the Great Barrier Reef there in Australia, because at some point it is our dream that once the children grow and we have the ability to go, we would love to see it. But I increasingly, we're seeing it bleached out.
More and more, this is happening, and the coral reefs are really vital to so many people's jobs and livelihoods. I mean, coral reefs not only are a natural barrier, they're also a habitat that fish get their food from. They're vital, and they're dying. And a lot of it is caused to warmer ocean temperatures, more acidification in the oceans. And, I mean, these are examples that are increasingly coming up. I mean, the list of impacts is growing.
So the question is then, where do we go from here? I know there are a lot of groups out there that are working to change the model that we're under. I know labor groups and the Sierra Club and a bunch of others started the Blue Green Alliance, the Apollo Alliance, and all of these groups to try and address these climate change issues, but also move us in a direction where maybe we get off the fossil fuels, maybe we move towards renewable energy in a rational way. Maybe we start moving in that direction?
It's all possible. I mean, first of all, the UN has some processes that are trying to do that. The UN Climate Change Convention has a process. The countries come together, and they're trying to figure out ways that they could collectively agree to reduce their carbon emissions. That's going to take a little time. But they agreed last year in Cancun to take some pretty significant steps, and if they follow that through, it will make a big difference. Also, the UN's, the IPCC, the people who do the science assessment on climate change, they issued a report just earlier this year that said that the world can produce a significant amount of its energy from renewable sources within a few years from now.
It's going to take the will to do it.
Absolutely. Countries have to do it. And a lot of countries are doing it.
Well, China's they're investing heavily in solar and wind. We're not so much. I mean, countries like Germany portion of their energy from renewable fuels. What concerns me is I'm worried about the BRIC countries, especially the developing world that's coming up and wanting to consume the energy like we do. Well, the Chinese passed us in coal consumption here recently.
They've also, taken the lead in electricity consumption as a country, not per capita, though.
Right.
People in these countries, they want to live the same lifestyle.
They want our lifestyle,
and
absolutely.
Who's going to say that they shouldn't?
Right.
Of course they have the right to. But they've also recognized that there are limits to what they can do. I mean, a lot of these BRIC countries, they're at the forefront of taking the lead in measures to plan a reduced carbon growth pattern. And that's something a number of developed countries have not done.
What happens if we do nothing? I mean, we've got the deniers in Congress. It doesn't exist. What happens if nothing? What happens if we allow those deniers to make our policy and we do nothing?
Well, I mean, doing nothing, what that means is that we continue pumping more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. The number is going up every year. It's relentless.
Michelle Bachmann says carbon dioxide is not a harmful gas.
Well, I mean, she's shown that. I mean, it's been shown. It's a greenhouse gas. It will affect climate change. It will have a big impact on it, and that's most scientists, acknowledge that.
I say let her hook up a hose to the back to the tailpipe of my car and suck on that for a while to see how harmful that is.
Well, I mean, a lot of people have all sorts of their own theories. Some will say that the world has been once colder than it is, it was once warmer than it is. It's all true, but the world has never warmed this fast as it is now, and that's what the big problem is. And this is caused by what humans are doing. This is unprecedented.
And on the short term, I think it's going to cost us more, not just in loss of land, but in the loss of food, the loss of being able to feed ourselves and produce crops to feed the growing population, because where are we? Almost near 7 billion people on this planet.
7 billion.
Right now?
We're going to reach 7 billion this October. At the end of October, the world's population is projected to hit 7 billion people, and it's going to continue rising. It's supposed to be, the latest UN estimates say that the world will have 10 billion people by the end of the century. And so how we're going to make sure that everybody has a good job, how everybody's going to get fed and shelter and all of these questions, we're going to figure this out. We're going to need to. That's one of the things why we have this big conference coming up next year, the Rio Plus 20, where the world is going to discuss these things on how we all can work to promote economic growth, how are we going to improve everybody's quality of life, and how do we do it and protect the environment at the same time? I mean, these are the three questions that have to be answered at the same time.
Yeah, and you look at it and you brought up how do we get people good jobs? How do we make sure that families are fed? How do we make sure that, people get health care? All of those things. When you have growing 10 billion people and you have this climate change issue that's going to make growing crops that much more difficult.
But we do think that one of the main things we're looking at is how to move, how to help countries move toward a green economy. We think that that kind of economy can create the jobs, it can create the wealth and prosperity that we need to see to make these things happen. And it is possible. I mean,
well, anything's possible. You just have to have the will to do it. You have to have the political will.
And absolutely.
And maybe there are countries around the globe that you could point out, but I just don't see us, especially right now in this day and time, having that political will. I mean, you know, the fight over just putting solar panels on people's houses. My 9-year-old says, Dad, why doesn't every school have solar panels on the roof? Why doesn't every Walmart and shopping mall, why aren't they all covered with solar panels?
You know,
I have no idea.
I think it's happening slowly, but since climate change has become a bigger issue, since it's become bigger on the radar screen, even in places where the political system has not responded yet, I think people have taken note, and I think people, even if they don't know about climate change, they know that being green is important, and I think this idea that emission reduction has really permeated the corporate world, it's in everybody's language now. And, I mean, that's important before anything could happen.
Absolutely.
And I think also people are seeing other countries doing it, and they're going to take the lead on all this technology stuff. And so there's a competitiveness issue
as well. I keep saying that whoever it is that has the ability to be energy independent, create their own energy from renewable sources, mm-hmm. whatever, they're going to be the leader in the 21st century, unquestionably.
That's very likely, yes.
Dan Shepard, Information Officer with the UN Department of Public Information. I appreciate your time. Great conversation, and keep up the great work, then.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure talking to you.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
I'll be working. As long as my two hands are fit to use, I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times. But without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Why don't you get up the sounds of the truth? Lock up each head, that's the Rick. Why can't we push me? You can't kill the processes. Can't kill. You can't kill the process. You can't murder the rebel. Murder. You can't murder the rebellion. Stop my feet, now the echo.
Neil Ford here, he's the chief of media for the U.S. Population Fund. It looks like we're going to be hitting about 7 billion people on this planet very, very soon. Neil, thanks for the time.
No problem. I think the number crunches of the date that the world's population will touch 7 billion at the 31st of October, so it's a Halloween event.
Interesting. Yeah. Will that 7 billionth child get a special prize?
You know, we did that for 6 billion. And the Secretary General was in Bosnia, and we actually chose a little baby who was designated the 6th billionth baby in the world. We're not going to do it that way this time.
Have you followed that 6th billionth child?
Yeah, we have, and he hasn't had a particularly great life, and he's had a lot of media attention because of that. And it's not really fair to designate one person as the 6th billionth person right. on the world. What we want to do this time is work with National Geographic. We're going to take pictures. UN Population Fund has offices in 150 different countries. On the day, we're going to take pictures of newborns all around the world. And we're going to work with National Geographic to put that into a picture of a composite baby, kind of a symbolic 7th billion baby. Because really, you know, 7 billion is about all of us. It's not about any one individual. It's about how we all come together and work to make the world a better place.
Because the sad thing is, as you pointed out, the kid probably hasn't had a great time of it in Bosnia there. And you know, that's another one of those things that you why saddle the kid with that if you don't have to?
Well, so we're using the occasion of 7 billion to say how can the world come together and how can 7 billion of us share this planet and all of us reach our potential. So the tagline we're using is 7 billion people counting on each other.
Interesting. Yeah. Because, you know, I got to be honest, 7 billion seems like an awful lot, and I question whether we're going to if we have the ability to sustain that kind of population growth growing forward, if we're going to be able to feed and clothe and house and give medical care and take care of all those people.
You know, there's no
I mean,
doubt
I know
about
we don't have a choice because it's going to happen regardless.
It's inevitable. That's one thing. And second thing, you know, you can look at 7 billion people as an achievement also. The reason there's 7 billion of us on this planet is because we're all living longer lives. More of us are surviving childhood. More births are safe. You know, there's lots of reasons why 7 billion of us are a success. Now, there's no doubt about it. It's a huge challenge also. Everybody knows it's straining the Earth's ecosystem. Everybody knows that the number of people are causing stresses in terms of the migration and things like that. But I think what we want to say is that we're here. 7 billion is inevitable, 8 billion is inevitable, 9 billion is inevitable. So rather than moan about it, what we've got to do is find a way to make it work.
Yep, figure out how we're going to feed everyone, make sure everyone gets clean water, and how we can live together in and somewhat of peaceful conditions.
I'm glad you brought that up, you know, because one of the things I've learned in this campaign is that the next 2 billion people that will join us are all going to live in cities. Those cities are all going to be in developing countries, and it's going to be to all of our advantage to make sure that those cities don't have huge slums, that there are, that they are places of opportunity and economic growth, so that the stress down there doesn't affect our livelihood, peace, and security up here.
Because the concern is that as you grow and you have this this mass poverty that, you know, I hope does not happen, but looking into the future, I don't know how almost we can't, given the direction that we're taking now with the mass inequality, the mass, the way the wealth is now being distributed between a handful at the very top and everybody else kind of scrambling for crumbs. I'm curious how you see the future going in that regard.
You know how I look at population? In northern developed countries, it's all about an aging population. Not enough young people coming up to support the old people.
We're going to need to immigrate.
Yeah. In the south, it's all about this huge youth boom. You know, there's more young people down there than there ever has been. And they all want jobs and opportunities and chances to be successful. There's got to be a way to make that into a win-win. You know, northern countries are going to need workers and people. Southern countries have way too many of those. Right now, our worlds are colliding in terms of conflict around those areas, but I think there are ways to work this out.
At the end of the day, do you see people moving across borders like goods and services are currently being pushed?
I don't know, but I think there has to be a way to find futures for all of those young people in the South now that need a future. And I think there's got to be ways for northern economies to adjust and take care of old people. And I think we've all got to think way more outside the box than we're thinking right now. And I think part of that is going to be countries or nations working in closer cooperation than they are now.
Yeah, some of the folks we talked to today about climate change, some of the other problems, energy, sustainability, all of those things. You know, as you have more people demanding more services, more resources, more food, more energy, it's going to be a massive strain on the planet.
But can you grow an economy without using more resources? Are there ways that you can add technology, add smarts, rather than add extra raw materials? I mean,
the hope is, yes.
Yeah, so that's, you know, a lot of that energy is going to come from the South, too. A lot of that new way of thinking is going to come from China and India and all the developing economies.
What does that mean here for the people in the U.S.?
Luckily, I'm a Canadian. Big resource.
What does it mean for people in North America?
It means that I think we have to look at success not in terms of how much we consume, but success in terms of how happy our lives are. So does that mean that we make less money and have more time off and have a better life because of it? I'll tell you what, if the whole world consumed at our level, there would be no future.
There'd be nothing left, right?
So as much as I want to give a better life down to people in the South, I also want to find a way that I can have a better life where I have less work stress, where I have more meaningful relationship with my family, where maybe I don't have two cars, I only have one car, but my overall life is a more satisfying life. And for me, that's the win-win.
Yeah, that is a win-win. It's a direction that I personally would be in favor of. But do you see that in where you look across the globe? Because as you see the Chinese, they're trying to, you know, they're trying to emulate us. They're trying to, you know, be us back in the 50s. Do you see them taking that path?
I think that they are thinking about this way more deeply than we are sometimes. They're worried about their own environment right now. They're worried about the effect that the one-child policy is going to have in terms of skewed population. I think they are trying to think this through. And I think that they have a culture that values spirituality that's still strong within them, although I know that they're discovering consumerism at a pretty quick clip. But
I saw a story. A kid the other day wanted an iPod. He wanted an iPod so bad, sold a kidney.
I don't know. I don't know what to say about that. But you know, they think, lots of people down there think that success is living like we do. Lots of people up here living like we do are not happy.
Right.
So can we have a bit of communication around that to say, you know, I wish I had more time to do things offline, off work, less stressful. I wish I could do more creative things as well as my 9-to-5 job. If we all thought like that, and if we all engaged with employers to say, could we build a life like that, maybe we would all consume a little bit less and be a little bit more happy. And could that be a model of something that people in China and India would want to emulate?
Is anyone doing this? I mean, because all I'm seeing, and I know, of course, this is just an American perspective. What I'm seeing is I'm seeing the destruction of labor rights. I'm seeing the destruction of the voice on the job. I'm seeing a push towards people working longer, harder, for less, even still less than if they were working less hours. What you've laid out here to me would be utopia.
Well, we live in a democracy, Rick. You know, I mean, these voices.
Do we?
We got to find ways to have those voices heard and have those viewpoints considered by policymakers.
Now, when six corporations own 80% of everything we see, hear, and read, is it possible to get those kind of views out in a meaningful way?
You and I are talking about them. That's a start.
Yep.
You know, I should bring it back to what my UN fund does. And, you know, what we really focus on is reproductive health for women and girls. We want to make sure that every birth is wanted, every pregnancy is wanted, and every birth is safe. And we strongly believe and are building a really good evidence base to prove it, that if you invest in women, that is one way to have these alternate ways of thinking considered. That if women are educated, if women have more decision-making power within the family and within their own communities, that those ways of thinking about what's a meaningful life, what's a meaningful economy, what's a meaningful way to consume are going to be more considered.
So maybe instead of imposing a one-child policy, you have educated women who can choose that.
That's exactly what we believe. We've never believed in imposing anything on anybody, but we do strongly believe in engaging with people and presenting them with new ideas and letting them choose for themselves. And we believe that given a choice, a woman is going to choose fewer children rather than less for a lot of children.
Right. Well, fewer children that you can support and feed and watch and nurture on until adulthood.
That's right.
Interesting. You know, because the way I've looked at all of this and the population problem to me, and it is a problem to me, and you've kind of allayed some fears, you know, a little optimism, and that's a good thing.
Listen, this is a huge challenge, but I think we've got to be optimistic about it. We've got to go into this saying we can solve this, because if we're defeatist about it, we truly are in trouble.
Because I see, you know, every day, you know, there are people who are starving to death, while we have silos of grain that are rotting in certain points. You know, I remember a guy telling me a story about in Haiti, where a pilot, you know, brought in a whole bunch of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and water from Florida, had no way of distributing it, and just, you know, probably went up to waste.
There are so many
work?
Well-meaning people out
sure.
there. So if we can just come up with the systems where they can actually do good, you know, it would help.
I agree. Yeah. You know, as we look down the road, this climate change issue, and I did want to bring this up on the population issue. As we see this climate change continue, as we see it harder to farm and harder to produce the food that we need, is this not going to be a massive challenge?
Yes, it is going to be a massive challenge.
And what are we doing, like with your group, what are you doing to try and...
Well, there are specialized agencies of the United Nations that look at food and agriculture, and they're FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome, the World Food Program, and IFAD, the International Fund for Agricultural Development. And those guys are working on sustainable solutions. They're, you know, one of the things that they're trying to puzzle through is the Green Revolution that worked so well in South and Southeast Asia. Why didn't that take off in Africa? And so, I mean, a lot is being done on that. Is it getting the world's attention? Is it getting the attention of people in the United States of America? You know, there's so much noise in the news out there that
we got to deal with Wienergate.
Exactly. That doesn't mean that there aren't people thinking about this stuff, because there are people thinking about this stuff, and there are world bodies are convening to say what's the way through it. You know, a lot of it has to do with agricultural subsidies in rich countries, and you know, can we get a level playing field there? And that's a for countries that give a lot of development assistance and think that they're nice guys, but then rake it all back because of their own unfair subsidies, that's a tough question.
You're beating up on our farm bill, are you?
I'm not beating up on anybody, but I'm pointing out that social justice is a hard thing to accomplish.
Yeah, excellent point. Neil Ford, I appreciate the time. He's the chief of media for the UN Population Fund. Neil, I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Change your mind. You know eternity can't ever change your mind. Do you know ALEC? You probably do, even though you never heard of it. Yes, it. Not a person. ALEC is the acronym for a secretive corporate-funded state policy front group, American Legislative Exchange Council. ALEC's exchange is very straightforward. It takes about $6 million a year from corporate powers in exchange for linking them directly to hundreds of right-wing state legislators. Like a speed dating service, ALEC convenes 2 to 3 dozen private confabs each year, putting corporate executives face-to-face with lawmakers. In these closed-door sessions, the special needs of corporations are matched with eager-to-please legislators who go back home to push the corporate agenda into state law. If your legislature is suddenly trying to take away workers' bargaining rights, outlaw citizen lawsuits against abusive corporations, privatize public schools, reduce corporate income taxes while raising taxes on retirees, and otherwise advance extremist special interest notions that go against the public will and the common good, chances are you have lawmakers who are carrying bills handed to them in one of ALEC's backroom tete-a-tetes. The organization brags that it has some 2,000 state legislators on its membership rolls and that members introduce about 1,000 ALEC bills each legislative session, passing about 200 of them a year. ALEC's insidious agenda is driven by a, quote, private enterprise board made up of such giants as AT&T, ExxonMobil, Koch Industries, Pfizer, and Walmart. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, don't bother asking ALEC for a list of the legislators who play in its corporate bawdy house. That's a secret, it says. But it's only kept secret from you. The corporate powers know all of ALEC's members intimately. Is your own legislator one of them? Well, ask him or her and see if they have the integrity to blush.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Wooling Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Hughley Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard a Republican today? Have you tried to spread your love to those who love the NRA? Your
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We are here in New York City for the UN Radio Day, broadcasting here in the UNICEF building, the Danny Kaye building room here in the UNICEF building. I'm sitting here with Dan Seymour. He is the chief of UNICEF's Gender and Rights Unit. Dan, thanks for taking time for me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Nice to be here.
Explain to me exactly what is the Gender and Rights Unit.
Okay, so we have kind of two jobs. The way I describe it, I talk about us having one eye looking inward, one eye looking outward, if that doesn't sound too strange. UNICEF has two primary functions. One is to do our own programs, and we have things going on at country level all around the world. And our job in the Gender and Rights Unit is to look and make sure that we're doing the right things and doing them right by talking about, are we paying enough attention to the challenges and difficulties that girls face, or the opportunities that are different between boys and girls in the work we do, whether it's in health or water and education. And then on the human rights side, we look at things like how well we're remembering how minority groups or indigenous groups are getting served by UNICEF's work. Then with that outward-looking eye, we look at all the money that other people have, that's much more than we have as UNICEF, and try and make sure it gets spent in the right way, and we kind of advocate for that working as best it can. So our money and resources are small compared to the money that the world has, you know, and if it chose to use it that way. So we can do a lot more sometimes by convincing other people to use their money than we can by spending our own.
Yeah, well, you know, when you start looking at the resources and how they've been allocated, I'm sure we could do an awful lot of good if we had the resources allocated. Well, maybe just a little bit differently.
You know, there's a famous statistic that people use. I can't say I've checked on it myself, but apparently the amount that Europe spends on pet food would be enough to make sure that every child in the world got a good education.
Oh, I don't
something along those lines. I mean, and it's the point is, it's entirely
bird
accurate.
Food
but
or whatever.
It's completely believable, you know? So you can see why it's, you know, I always say UNICEF, you know, there's a lot of organizations, great organizations working for children around the world, you know, and you can work for any of them and you can support any of them, and that's really great. What's special about UNICEF is we got given the job by the General Assembly, by that collection of every country in the world, to be the custodians of standards, you know. There's this Convention on the Rights of the Child, these principles, and we're the ones that go around trying to make sure people live up to that and are mandated to do that. That's special to us.
Well, you have that mandate. You know, you have that mandate. Do you have a mechanism to make sure that it gets done? A lot of times you can have the best intentions in mind if you have there are no teeth in the dog, you know, no bite.
Well, you know, the UN has its various ways of trying to push for stuff to happen, but I'm not going to pretend that there's, you know, some way that the UN clicks its fingers and governments go, oh, okay, the UN said it and we'll do it. And certainly, you know, UNICEF works by partnering with governments, and we persuade and we make the case and we pull together the data and the evidence, and we find good practice and we try and convince people. And what I've found, you know, in the work I've been doing, whether it's been at a country level or here in New York, is, you know, UNICEF's name carries a lot of weight.
Right.
And that's another sort of real advantage that we have. So it's one of the things we're really lucky about. You know, when UNICEF comes along and says something and makes a point, people do tend to listen, more so than if we were some, you know, other organization that didn't have that kind of standing that we enjoy. So, you know, that helps. You know, that makes a really big difference. So I'm not going to pretend that we go around and we click our fingers and they do it, but you'd be surprised how much people listen to
us.
But you know?
There's somebody's out there watching. Let's go back to this idea of the Gender and Rights Unit, because in talking about the gender issues, you know, are you talking about prostitution? Are you talking about for girls? Are you talking about, you know, boys being drafted into the military, soldier, stuff like that? Is that what we're focusing on? Or do you have a different focus? Because I know there's some other UN groups that look at children being drafted into militaries and you know, the girls being exploited in other ways.
I'll give you an example of the kind of things in this area. So to take trafficking for an example, right? So we know trafficking is a problem, and we know that we want to deal with it, and so we're looking to figure out, okay, how does it really work? You know, what's making it happen? And by understanding what's making it happen, how can we stop it? You know, what are the drivers of this problem, and how do we undermine them or tackle them? And what we do in my unit is we would engage an issue like that, and we'll say, well, how much is that problem coming from the way gender works in that country? You know, how much is it to do with, I mean, take trafficking, for example. You know, I was in Vietnam for a while, and there's a whole issue of women being trafficked from Vietnam to China, which Chinese government, Vietnamese government, and UNICEF collaborate on to try and address that. Well, one of the things you need to understand is that in China, because of the sex imbalance they have, where they've got more men than women, you know, men have trouble finding a bride, and a lot of this is to do with kind of getting Vietnamese women over for marriage. So there's an example where you need to understand that there's those sorts of dynamics behind the trafficking problem if you're going to tackle it. If you don't understand that's what's going on, you'll do the wrong thing. Right.
Because I would have thought cheap labor would have been the draw.
Well, that is in some places, and that's fine. But similarly there, where cheap labor is the draw, and you're entirely right, but then you need to understand, well, hang on, what kind of cheap labor, right? Is it to do with working in agriculture, or is it to do with domestic work? If it's to do with domestic work, is it boys or girls that you're talking about getting involved in that? And if it's girls, well, what happens to girls when they find themselves taken from their home, staying in somebody else's house, earning a tiny amount of money and completely dependent on that employer? Well, you've got to understand that it's not just children without being, you know, clear about whether they're boys or girls. All sorts of differences that you appreciate when you understand the gender dynamics going on in a problem like that, and when you appreciate them, it helps you do a better job of dealing with it. You know, whether you're trying to stop it or whether you're trying to actually make things better for kids who've actually been caught up in that.
Do you find on the gender side that you're more aware of what happens to girls or women than you are of boys and men?
I think
because of the obvious academic inadequacies, the inequality there. That girls may not get the education and thus not be able to take care of themselves.
What we normally say is that in terms of gender problems, gender inequalities, most of the time it's the people who come out worst from it are girls and women. Yeah, that's entirely true. But there are all sorts of issues which relate to and disadvantage men and boys too. But actually the really important thing is what we try and figure out is when you want to solve these things, if you're worried about, for example, that girls don't go to school, that's not a women's issue. The people that you need to deal with, the people you need to bring on board to make that better, are not only the mothers or the girls themselves. You've got to be talking to men, and you've got to understand the role of men. What is it that men did or that they didn't do that contributed to girls not ending up in school? And why did they do that? What was it about how they grew up and what they understood about what a man should be and what a boy should do and what a girl should do? What was it in there that led to them doing whatever it is that they're doing that's not helping get those girls into school? It's understanding all those sorts of things. And it's not the full story. There's all sorts of other things. I've got colleagues who work in education, but it's a really important piece of the puzzle. And if you don't have that piece of the puzzle, you won't do as good a job. And that's what we're tasked to do inside of UNICEF.
It sounds like you're tasked with changing culture and changing, you know, the mores of the community in a way, because, you know, I think most of those are male-dominated cultures, if I'm wrong.
Male-dominated cultures is the norm, yeah. And it's not...
I got to be honest, you know, I have friends who want to take us back to those days here in this country.
Yeah.
And as
Absolutely.
A male here, sometimes I wouldn't mind that. But I've got two daughters who I would not want to be in that situation, if that makes any sense.
You know, it's fact, I've got two daughters. My eldest is going to be 7 next week, and my youngest is 5. And when people talk about this, I always say, actually, you know, for a lot of men, this idea of a world that's gender equal is what I want. I mean, I think I have a... We all talk about women's rights. But what about my right to live in a world where my daughters, or your right, Rick, to live in a world where your daughters get all the opportunities that boys get? You know, that's a right that we have as fathers
and girls. Well, before I had daughters, I may have argued differently.
Really?
Maybe. You know, I don't know.
Yeah,
I can't say.
Maybe.
You know, maybe before that. But, you know, when you have daughters, you maybe I think a little bit differently, I think.
I certainly think it helps you to understand in a way that you wouldn't necessarily. I mean, there's my wife,
I've
my two
you.
Daughters, and my two female cats, you know? So I'm in a pretty, there's not a lot of testosterone going on in my house. So I've learned at home a little bit too. But, yeah, I guess you're right. You know, there are certain things you learn at home you wouldn't necessarily learn at work.
Yeah, because I want my daughters to have every opportunity. Yeah. I want them to be able to take care of themselves, not be dependent on someone unless they want to be.
Yeah.
And those options, those choice things, I think we're very fortunate in this country and in a lot of developed countries to be able to choose.
Absolutely. I tell you, my older daughter, you know, I say she's going to be 7. And she asks questions, you know, because she sees what I do, or somebody comes over and shows some photos, and she's like, hang on, why are those girls being treated like that? You know, to her, she doesn't understand why some of these things happen in other parts of the world, because she's lucky to grow up somewhere where it doesn't. And you realize that, you know, through the eyes of a child who hasn't necessarily been socialized to think that these differences and discriminations are normal. You really brings it in, you know, highlights it. It brings it into relief for you. It's I mean, one of the interesting things about doing what I do is you realize how much all of us carry around a whole sort of baggage around what's male and what's female. And that baggage maybe here is not, you know, in a country like the US where I've lived for a while now, maybe that baggage is not so detrimental. But when you see how that baggage manifests itself, it plays itself out in countries where people are really poor and where they're right on the edge between survival or not surviving or going to school or not going to school or being safe or not being safe. See how that plays out. That's a really, really big deal. You know, you can so exactly like you're saying, those things that you even see the sort of echoes of here, when you take them into places where people are really stressed and life's kind of harder, they become a really serious factor, you know?
Yeah, where people are living at the margins and I understand it. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Dan Seymour. He's the chief of UNICEF's Gender and Rights Unit. You know, and getting back to this, you mentioned that you were in Vietnam, and I'm curious, and I think it would be worth looking into what kind of stories you brought back from there. What is it that caught your attention, something that made you stop and take pause, maybe something that made you happy?
Well, you know, I mean, Vietnam's an incredible country. You know, it's an incredible country. And it was wonderful to be there. But one of the things, I mean, there's a lot of amazing things about Vietnam, but one of the incredible things is just the amount of energy and industry going on. Right? These are people who will build a house faster than I can get somebody to come in and unblock my drain, you know? They are incredible, and they work through the night, and they come in, thousands of them, and they just, you know, and you look in Hanoi where I was, and there's these cranes and diggers, and everything's going up, and the rate of progress is incredible. I mean, the economic growth in Vietnam over the last 20 years or so is spectacular, much, much better than most of the countries you could think of. So, you go there, and you're so impressed at how fast things are getting better. But what you find in Vietnam is the real challenge they have is that progress is not really very, I mean, it's all very well to sit in Hanoi.
Is it stable? I mean, is it domestic growth? Or is this the
Chinese
coming
domestic.
In?
No.
Is this the U.S. corporations coming in?
No, they have a very well-educated population. This is a culture that values education extremely highly. But where, you know, because things aren't so expensive, they can work for lower rates. You have a very educated population that with relatively low labor costs, and that drives primarily export-led growth.
Right.
But the thing is, this big Vietnamese success story starts to look a lot less clever if you're one of the 13 million or so ethnic minority Vietnamese living in the mountain areas. And I can tell you, you know, near where I lived in Hanoi, which was, I'm not pretending it was a nice area, you know, there was a BMW dealership opened up while I was there. And I could get in a plane, fly for about 45 minutes or so, I don't remember the exact distance, but, you know, and then drive into these highland areas and see kids sitting in the back of classrooms, you know, without the money for decent clothes, with no books, you know, struggling to understand what the teacher was saying because the teacher was talking in the majority language, King, and they were from minorities. They didn't speak that language even. So, you know, five-year-old kids sat at the back, no idea what's going on. Classrooms, you know, in very difficult circumstances. And you realize, you know, that gap between that BMW dealership and that five-year-old kid at the back of the classroom with nothing, who's trying to learn but just has no chance. I mean, what are you going to do? You sit there, you don't even know what they're saying, you know? And you realize that challenge of making sure that all of that prosperity and all of that progress gets enjoyed by the people and the children who need it most. That, I mean, you know, I'd never seen that so stark. I mean, you kind of, you know it. I mean, no child left behind. Okay, we get the idea. You see across the globe.
That is an issue of our time. How do we share in the prosperity, the wealth that's being created, especially by the workers in places like Vietnam and China who are being exploited right now.
Well, I think it's difficult to sort of pin down the exact dynamic of what happens and what will work best for them, because, you know, there's all sorts of different models. But what we did manage to do in UNICEF, which was great during my time there, and what I'm, you know, really proud of, is working with the government to say, well, maybe you can change the way you do education so that kids from minorities can learn at least for a couple of years in their own language. They know what's going on. They have some time to settle into school before you switch into the language that they're struggling with. We managed to get them to allocate more funds to special programs for people in the poorest areas to give them a chance to kind of catch up a little bit. You know, so all of those sorts of things that we were able to do in UNICEF were really great. And I think, you know, the Vietnamese government's pretty serious about trying to close those sorts of gaps if it can. I mean, it has a whole political ideology, I guess, which it justifies on how well it does in serving the poorest in a lot of ways. So they take it really seriously. And you said right at the beginning when we started talking, you know, how can UNICEF get any leverage on these governments when we talk about these things? Well, governments like that, you know, you don't need to push them. You just need to show them, really. I mean, you know, you work with them. Yeah, exactly. Because they want to do it. They're not ill intentioned. And you know, if you can show them some examples of what's worked. You know, we brought over a former minister of finance from Colombia to go and talk with the vice president about how they were going to do their plans, and we, you know, prepped him and we worked with him and he gave them a report and we worked on it. And you know, they took that Colombian experience and he basically said, I remember it was really striking. He said, look, you know, what we've learned in Colombia is that you can set up a country so that it depends on having poor people. In other words, your economy needs poor people, otherwise you can't function, right? So you're selling coffee, but to sell coffee you need poor people to pick the coffee so the coffee's cheap enough for you to sell it. If you want to go that way, go that way, but be aware you'll just have a bunch of really, really poor people the whole time because you will need it. That's how you set your country up. Or you can say we're going to invest in people, we're going to go with a productivity-based economy. And he was great. I mean, you know, the Vietnamese were listening, and they're so, I mean, Vietnamese people, that country likes to learn. I mean, my God, these people listen. They take education so seriously, and they're just sitting there absorbing it from him and taking it in. And, you know, when you as UNICEF can be, I mean, that's what I really love that UNICEF can do. You know, I can send a message to my colleagues, and I can say, look, there's this thing going on in Vietnam. Find me a good person from somewhere. And from right across the other side of the world, some colleague, you know, pings up on the email, and suddenly I've got the finance minister of Colombia showing up in Hanoi, you know, with UNICEF having sorted it out and facilitated it and briefed him and prepared him, talking to the vice president of Vietnam. I mean, that's great. And the Vietnamese saying, okay, and listening and changing what they do. That's, you know, that's the kind of stuff that I really, you know, enjoy. You talk about what do I take away, what I really love, what sticks with me, what I'm really happy about. It's that kind of thing that I like best. Yeah.
You know, and it's one of those... It's one of those things I can see that you enjoy what you do, and I'm sure you do it very well. In talking about Colombia, though, I got to be honest. You know, we're talking about a free trade agreement here. I'm not thrilled with the idea of having a trade agreement with Colombia, a place where they take trade unionists up and throw them out of planes or shoot them in the head. I've just got some problems with that.
Yeah, I mean, we work in all sorts of situations where, you know, governments do things that maybe wouldn't be what we'd like them to be doing ideally. But, you know, one of the things about our mandate is that we're there working on children's issues, and we have to make a call as to how to best interact with all sorts of different governments and all sorts of circumstances. And we have people out there who are put there precisely because they can handle and understand those sorts of difficult situations and figure out, you know, where best to do it. And sometimes it's hard, you know. I mean, you know, I'm not going to name specific countries, but there are times when I know my colleagues have had some real challenges with some pretty difficult governments, and you can probably guess which ones they are. But that's what we do. That's our job, you know. And most of the time we do it okay, I think.
I give you credit for it. It's great talking to you. I appreciate you sitting down
and
sharing a little bit of your experience with us. Thank you so much. Dan Seymour, chief of the UNICEF's Gender and Rights Unit.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming to the USA.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Let's get right to it. H.R. 6419. I am flipping mad over this. WTF, man. WTF is the only thing I can think of. The Emergency Unemployment Compensation Continuation Act, H.R. 6419. They needed to get two-thirds of the vote. They needed to get 290 votes. They couldn't get that. They got 258. You expect the Republicans to stand in stark opposition. 21 of them did flip over and vote for the bill. But for me, it was the 11 Democrats who turned their backs on working people. And good. Seven of them lost. So we're done with those. We're done with those centrist, middle-of-the-road Democrats, the conservative Democrats. Get rid of those bums because they weren't much good to begin with.
Organize.